Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Kenneth Dow Schmidt, professor of labor and employment law at the Indiana University, going to be here talking about yesterday's testimony as the sole voice of the working class in front of the congressional hearing up against four. Anti-labor folks. Shouldn't say it like that. They were bending over backwards to say how much they just like unions. Oh yes. But you know, we should have more of them and, you know, just a whole bunch of things. We just love them. Oh boy, so happy. But they're all there to destroy them. Especially the union busting attorney from Jackson Lewis. Really just an amazing moment when the union buster goes, well, we're not union busters. No. We would never do what we say on our website. We would never do that. So it'll be interesting to talk to the good professor about the testimony, but also the direction of the country, because, you know, that hearing to me highlights the fact that in this country we have had such a long period between having the discussion of do we have rights as workers or don't we? Are we such a business-friendly society that we say, whatever you want, boss, whatever you want, massa, we'll do whatever. Is that how far we've gone back? So there'll be an interesting question there. Also in the third hour, we're going to be talking with Richard Vogel, reporter and editor of CombatingGlobalization.com. Going to be here talking about the cross-border trucking issue. Now there are groups who are coming out saying, we need to stop it. It's already been signed. The deal is almost done. Should have been organizing this, since 1994, to stop and kill this, but it'll be interesting to see where this is going to take us as we move forward. Because I got to be honest, I think it's real trouble. I think it's trouble for the industry. I think it's dangerous precedent. And I think it's going to cost us jobs when we can least afford it. Especially when you're talking about areas, Allentown area, this area, building up big super warehouses. Now those warehouses, who knows? They may end up locating south of the border. Why? Cheaper labor. You know, subsidies from the government, you know, all kinds of reasons. And, you know, cheap transportation. Now they can run massive, massive hubs out of Juarez or out of some of the border towns in Mexico. Bad, bad thing in my opinion. Also your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. There's a new poll out. No surprise here, finds that a full 60% of people in the country, including 50% of Republicans, believe that it's more important to keep Social Security and keep Medicare just as they are rather than to reduce the deficit. And you know what's amazing? Among Republicans, the only group, the only groups that say, you know what, let's go after Social Security, let's take over that safety net, are Tea Party twits and people making over 75 grand. The rest of the folks saying, well, you know, we like to have a safety net. And for me, you know, I keep going back to one thing in my opinion, and this is one of those personal household kind of things, and I rarely like to make household analogies unless I have to. And in this case, this is one of those moments where you don't gamble your rent money. You don't gamble your food money. You don't gamble what is your basic structure. You know, I've heard stories over the years that, you know, I've had friends tell me, oh, it's just so wonderful, like the lottery. There was a story a number of years ago in Florida where a guy living in his car with his family, a couple of kids, spent his last $20 on the lottery and hit it big, like $100 million or something obscene like that. And people were saying, oh, isn't that wonderful? And I think I'm probably the only person who said, no, that's not wonderful. It's disgusting and it's wrong. He took his last $20 that he could have taken some, put in the car gas to go to a job interview, or the last couple of bucks to feed his kids, and he gambled it away. How many people do that and lose? You're sending the wrong message here. Now all these people who are struggling to get by think, oh, well, you know what? Instead of paying the mortgage, instead of putting food on the table, let's gamble because we got a good chance of winning it all. To me, this is what putting Social Security on the table is akin to. It's akin to taking your last 20 bucks out of your pocket and slapping it on the table and going, I'm going to gamble it. I'm going to risk it. And I'm not there yet. Sorry. And, you know, the left has been doing such a backpedaling job to try and support the president on this, and I just cannot. And then the whole discussion has been, oh, well, you know, we're going to raise the cap, or we're going to means test it. Do you really, honestly, truthfully believe the Republicans are going to allow that to happen? No. They're going to go after the big pot of gold. You have just opened up to them the big pot of gold. Now, if they're willing to do what it's going to take to get that pot of gold is a different story. The president's not going to leave that out there and not get something for it. But here's my problem with that. My problem is, I don't think we should be gambling our safety net. The majority of people in this country say, look, the very wealthy have been doing wildly well for a couple of generations now. It's time for them to kick in. We don't need to gamble to get to that. And you know what? If the Republicans don't come along, you vote their behinds out next November. There are consequences. And Nancy Pelosi said something today. Again, you know, I'm with her on this. Not always with her, but I'm with her on this. She said, we're not going to reduce the deficit or subsidize tax cuts for the rich on the back of America's seniors and working families. Not going to do it. She said, no benefit cuts in Medicare or Social Security, and we have serious concerns also about what's happening with Medicaid. And I told you, Medicaid's done. Understand that. Medicaid is done. But at the end of this, and I think Pelosi was right coming out and saying, what have the Republicans brought forth in the way of jobs plans? The way we get out of this mess, no matter what we want to talk about, the only way out of this are jobs, putting people back to work. And how many jobs plans have the Republicans put up? How many have they put on the floor of the House? Not one. Zero. Zip. They got a nice pledge, though. I got a 48-page document. 27 pages of smiling white people. 21 pages of, you know, kind of cut and paste, redundancy, a lot of reiteration. But they say jobs, jobs, jobs. And I see nothing. Nothing. The Democrats, they brought up 10, they're saying 10 bills. 10 bills that were to create jobs. Infrastructure, alternative energy, you name it. They've tried it. Republicans have voted it down. So tell me who's serious about this debt thing. Because I'm not seeing it on the Republican side of the aisle. And what I'm seeing on the Democratic side, that the president's seriously talking about putting Social Security on the table, he's going to have some serious problems. And I think Bernie Sanders summed it up best when a reporter asked him if he was convinced that they'll be able to pass some type of debt limit in the Senate with changes to Social Security. And he said, look, quote, again, it's hard to talk about what other 99 other people are going to do, but I think there really is a disconnect. And I think Sheldon, White House, the guy from Rhode Island, made this point when he was speaking. But what the White House is doing and the rest of the Senate, what I can say I've heard, including the people who you might not expect from hearing it from, that if they bring from the Senate a piece of crap that really comes down on working families and the elderly and the sick and the children, and they expect me to matter-of-factly vote for it, they have another thing coming. And look, you know, not going to happen. Sheldon Whitehouse said, look, it's Social Security, Medicare, off the table. Should be off the table. And Social Security, one of these things, I don't even know how it got on the table. And I know the president wants to do something big. We want something huge. To me, that's not it. Sorry, not going there with you. Can't do it. And I think Congressman Keith Ellis hit it best when he said, look, Social Security is not contributing to the deficit. It's a standalone program. And it's not, you know, it's got some problems, but those are fixable. And he said, you know, the problem is we're asking the poor folks to sacrifice. And the wealthy folks, not so much. And he had the right point. He said, you know, we should be asking these wealthy folks to do the patriotic thing. And step up and actually say, you know what, we're gonna chip in. We're gonna make sure that we help our country. And that's the question I have for our very wealthy class, for our CEOs and our big multinational corporations. You know, where do you stand? Because the reality is what I'm seeing is a lot of people turning their back. Say, well, we've got ours, screw you. Why aren't these companies hiring people? They're sitting on boatloads of cash that we've given to them. And now you're seeing this, and I told you, Medicaid is done. Understand that. And Kentucky is another one. Florida started it. Now Kentucky's going along the lines. They're privatizing their Medicaid services. 815,000 people on Medicaid in the state of Kentucky. I guess here's the release. Starting in October, Medicaid recipients in much of the state will choose among three companies that will compete to manage their care. Question is, they're all going to collude. And the question is who's going to be served by it? I'm saying the people who are going to be served by it, the profiteers, at the expense of those who need it the most. But again, back to this jobs thing. And the president today was in the Rose Garden. He laid out his four-point economic development plan. This is the recovery plan. This is it. We're going to rebuild America. We're going to streamline the patent process. Because, you know, it's too hard for patents. Just kind of too hard. You know, we need those entrepreneurs getting out there and more patents. And we need more trade deals. Yeah, more of those failed trade deals. And we need middle-class families to know that they're going to have a tax cut next year. And step five, of course, is underpants. And for those of you who get it, congratulations. For the rest of you, you're just going to have to figure it out. But this is what the president had to say.
There are a few things that we can and should do right now.
Maybe not. This is what the president had to say.
There are a few things that we can and should do right now to redouble our efforts on behalf of the American people. Let me give you some examples. Right now, there are over 1 million construction workers out of work after the housing boom went bust, just as a lot of America needs rebuilding. We connect the two by investing in rebuilding our roads and our bridges and our railways and our infrastructure. And we could put back to work right now some of those construction workers that lost their jobs when the housing market went bust. Right now, we can give our entrepreneurs the chance to let their job-creating ideas move to market faster by streamlining our patent process. That's pending before Congress right now. That should pass. Today, Congress can advance trade agreements that will help businesses sell more American-made goods and services to Asia and South America, supporting thousands of jobs here at home. That could be done right now. Right now, there are a lot of middle-class families who sure could use the security of knowing that the tax cut that I signed in December to help boost the economy and put $1,000 in the pockets of American families, that that's still going to be around next year. That's a change that we could make right now.
And aside from the rebuild part, which I'm right there with, infrastructure, build bridges, roads, kind of sounds like a Republican. Deregulate, trade, tax cuts. We're right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. In Wisconsin, they had Walkerville. In New York City, Bloombergville. And now in Minnesota, they have Downeyville. The name targets State Representative Keith Downey, due to his role in proposing a 15% state employee cut that would see nearly 5,000 lose their jobs. Minnesota's government has been shut down for 8 days, and workers have been gathering daily in hopes legislators will reach an agreement with Governor Mark Dayton. St. Paul City Council member Melvin Carter spoke on Wednesday.
If they succeed, their plan would leave us with closed libraries, locked rec centers, fewer police and firefighters, and even higher property taxes than we're already paying today. We deserve better.
Both sides are blaming each other for the shutdown. However, the governor isn't up for re-election until 2014, and many of the Republicans in the legislature are up next year.
We are watching you. There's a report card coming. You better get to work or you won't be coming back. Thank you.
The theme heard in Minnesota echoes the theme throughout the country. Protesting taxpayers want state governments to stop balancing budgets on the backs of low and middle income workers and instead raise taxes on the top 2%. Minnesota AFL-CIO President Shar Knutson.
So their so-called budget plan that would have only balanced the budget on the backs of middle-class families like you and me, and not even that, it would eliminate jobs rather than create jobs.
390 Blue Cross Blue Shield workers in the Buffalo, New York area are locked out of their jobs despite being willing to work. Hundreds of members of the Office of Professional Employees International Union, Local 212 in Buffalo, New York, are protesting the lockout by HealthNow New York Incorporated, doing business as Blue Cross Blue Shield of Western New York. Dina Fox, business representative of OPEIU Local 212, says the company refused to agree on a fair contract as the union tried to negotiate more job security.
Before we got out of bargaining on that night, our membership received robocalls from their employer telling them not to report for work. This is not a strike. This is a lockout. The workers did not come together and say, we don't want to work. The workers are saying, we want to work and we want a fair collective bargaining agreement.
Fox says 164 positions have been lost at Buffalo's Blue Cross Blue Shield facility in the past 4 years. The union is trying to bring jobs back while the company insists on total outsourcing freedom. Fox says these workers are just middle-class Americans trying to provide for their families.
These are everyday, day-to-day folks trying to pay their bills, make a living, and make sure they can provide for their families.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome to the new dark age.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So what should be on the table? You know, and I've been thinking about this quite often. You know, the reality is I think the debt ceiling is an issue in and of itself. What's happened is you've got the Republicans who right now see this as a bargaining chip and a hostage situation, a ransom opportunity. They see a way to cash in and you know, pretty much push their ideology and push the goalposts further right. Really at the harm of the nation. The rest of the world is watching, and I know people are like, well, I don't care what the rest of the world says. But if you listen to the right wing, all the right wings are going, well, Obama's not leading, and the rest of the world, they know Obama's not leading. And I go, well, which is it? We're either not leading or we're not supposed to be leading. Which is it? Explain to me when we're supposed to lead by example and when we're not. Because what we're doing right now, what the Republicans have backed us into right now, is a situation where the rest of the world sees us as a bunch of petulant children who cannot come up with a solution to our problem. And, you know, it would be okay if we weren't going to pull them down with us. And that's the key here. We don't know what happens August 3rd. We don't know if the entire world collapses with us. We don't know. Nobody knows, Jake. Nobody has a clue. And there are a lot of predictions, a lot of doomsdayers. And there's some of the right who said nothing's going to happen. The world will still, everything is fine.
I think the Republicans, and there's some in the party, they won't say it publicly, but they know that the Republican Party, depending on how they handle it, and these, make no mistake, the president, these are huge stakes, but also the Republican Party risk destroying their own party. If the American people perceive that a large part of the Republican Party is willing to take this country down economically, they could be out of power for a while. And I do believe that. So that's why this scenario is so big. Now, there's some who believe that it actually couldn't pass the Senate, couldn't pass the House. There's some who believe if there are things in that bill which, in the eyes of the conservatives, raise taxes, if there's as many as 100, which some believe there are, and depending on what's on the table from the Democratic side on Social Security and Medicare, you could have a coalition of the left and the right that could pull that bill down in the House.
So the question then is what should be on the table? Should anything be on the table? Personally, I think we negotiate the debt ceiling based on the realities of the situations that we have. We have bills that have to be paid. We have a country that has to be run. I say this is a separate issue. Everything else, the discussions of cutting spending, the discussions of raising revenue, those should be done separately, in my opinion. Because what then ends up happening is you end up drawing lines in the sand. And where you are now is, you know, I'm drawing a line in the sand that, look, I'm not going to cut my grandmother's Social Security. And I'm not going to cut the promise to future generations that have been made to them. Not going to do it. The Republicans, as you've said, Jake, have put the line in the sand. We're not going to raise taxes on rich people. Not going to do it. Then there's some spots in the middle, like this health care tax break that evidently has now found its way onto the table. And if you remember during the health care discussion, when, if you want to call it that, it was basically the Republicans doing everything they could do to poison pill that even. If you remember the whole discussion that went on, it was about taxing health care benefits. And I think part of me thinks that that discussion woke people up a little bit and say, wow, our health care costs are really high. But they were talking about these Cadillac plans. So are the Cadillac plans now on the table, or are they plans for everybody? Will everybody in the working class, now understand, and I believe this wholly, the middle class of this country are the people who depend on that health care tax break the most, because employers will just drop health care altogether, or they're just going to pass the tax on to their employees. So one of two things is going to happen there, and it's bad for the middle class. Because in this country, you can't possibly be in the middle class without health security. Having some measure of health insurance to make sure that if you get sick, you're not bankrupt. If you get sick, you don't lose your home. You got to have that. What they're talking about doing, and they're saying that this provision, this tax provision, costs the country about $117 billion a year. So when employers provide their employees health care, that tax that they're thinking about going after, $117 billion a year. They're saying maybe it's on there. Maybe they cap it at a certain amount. Maybe they take it off completely. And then what happens to the health care bill that they passed last year? To me, again, you know, I look at this and there's so much here. This, again, something very targeted that will really harm the working class. And this is somewhere where the teetotalers and I think me can agree. This is a tax increase that I can't swallow. Because it's going to hurt working people. The people who can afford it the least. Now, they frame it as, oh, the people with Cadillac healthcare plans. Do I have a Cadillac healthcare plan? My family plan costs, you know, somewhere around $16,000, $17,000 a year. Is that a Cadillac plan? It's a very good plan, yes. But is it the Cadillac plan? Is it the one the CEOs have? Oh, that's right. They pay cash out of their pockets. Is it the one that Rush Limbaugh has? No, he paid cash out of his pocket. He doesn't need insurance. This is about working people to me. And it's on the table, evidently. So when you start opening up that box, and this is a whole other reason that, you know, I'm concerned about a constitutional convention here in the state. Once you open up that box and you can say all you want, we're going to set parameters. Once you get to that table, you never know what falls out.
It all comes down to who sets the parameters. That's what it comes down to.
Well, no, on this debt talk, nobody threw Social Security out on the table. So the president said, there it is. There's my last 20.
Well, if I can if I can make a comment, you mentioned your policies, and I know you have family coverage. The problem was, right now, you would still qualify. But if in fact, in years to come, they didn't keep factoring in inflation, which could easily happen, more and more and more people would have their health care taxed. That was the problem. It wasn't the effect right now, but in the future. And you know.
Well, that's down the line. That's the health care bill.
And and you know the Republicans will probably try to do exactly that.
But this is talking about doing.
Right. This is a little bit different.
This is looking at maybe taking it away, maybe lowering that number. We don't know what it is they're talking about, but we do know it's on the table. So, again, what should be on the table? And I look at this story in the New York Times today. It says, when poor people are given medical insurance, they not only find regular doctors and see doctors more often, but they also feel better and are less depressed and are better able to maintain financial stability. This is all according to a new large study scale that provides the first rigorously controlled assessment of the impact of Medicaid. And my response to that was kind of like, well, duh. People with health insurance go to the doctor more often. Yep. They generally feel better. Yep. They generally have a little better financial stability. Yep. Seems pretty reasonable to me, which, again, is probably part of the reason that the Republicans are so hell-bent on destroying Medicaid. And they look at this study in Oregon because the state of Oregon was running out of money. So they had to choose who was going to get. And this is what's going to happen. Understand, this is going to happen. Kentucky's got 815,000 people. 815,000 people on Medicaid. Trust me, when they privatize this, they're going to cut that by at least a third. They're going to disqualify a bunch of people. So this study kind of did that in the past and said, okay, we're going to take a control group of 6,000 we're going to give Medicaid to, 6,000 that, well, they're on their own, and we're going to follow them. And what it came out with is it came out, you know what? The people who had Medicaid, they went to the doctor more. 35% more likely to go to the clinic or a doctor. 15% were more likely to use the prescription drugs properly. 30% were more likely to be admitted into a hospital. Women who had health insurance, they were 60% more likely to have mammograms so that they catch things early. And those with insurance were 20% more likely to have their cholesterol checked. Again, a lot of preventative stuff. There were 70% more likely to go to a particular clinic or see a particular doctor. And 55% said they have a doctor who usually saw them. So what you saw is relationships being built. And what they found out is people were feeling better. They said that their lives were feeling better. In fact, the people who felt excellent increased by 25%. 40% of them said they were less likely to say that their health had worsened. So a lot of positive things came out of this. And so Oregon figured, hey, we've got to figure out how to get people insurance. So 90,000 people signed up for the rolls. They had, in 2008, 90,000 people signed up for this. They had to hold a lottery. They got to decide who got insurance by a lottery. 10,000 people won. They got their voucher. And they won the lottery. They got health insurance. What does that say about us as a country? Where you win, where your lottery winnings are health insurance. But Oregon did something pretty amazing. They found the money, and they covered the other 80,000 who had been turned down by the lottery. And what the study found is those who had insurance were less likely to have unpaid bills, less likely to have bills sent to collection, were less likely to borrow money or fail to pay other bills. It's good for the economy. And, you know, again, you know, it's that part of the middle class. It's being, you know, when you, it's kind of a mindset if you think about it. If you're falling, if I'm going to the doctor and I don't have the money to pay for it, I'm just, well, screw it. I'm not going to pay it. I don't have the money. Got to go to the emergency room. I broke my leg. I don't have the money. There's nothing I can do about it. The heck with it. That mentality, I do believe, goes over into every other part of your life. Because now you're hounded constantly. The doctors have to see you. The hospital, the emergency room has to see you. They have to fix that leg, but they're going to hound you to death. And that leads to a whole plethora of problems. And that's why I truly believe we have to have health care for everyone. I mean, just a basic plan. I'm not talking the Cadillac plan that you can get boob jobs. I'm talking basic health care. You break your leg, you get it fixed. You get sick, you go get a doctor, get a little antibiotics, clear it right up so you don't make everybody else sick. Does that make sense to you, Jake? I mean,
Absolutely. You're talking something akin to Medicare. Wow. What a unique idea if we could only do that for all the people.
And the thing is it's on the table. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. What do you think back after this?
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
They're back. Citigroup, Coca-Cola, IBM, Merck, and dozens of other major U.S. corporations are back in Washington like hogs at the trough, demanding to be fed another tax boondoggle. This is not the first pig out for these oinkers. In 2005, having stashed huge profits in foreign countries and tax havens, the multinational giants came to Washington offering Congress a heck of a deal. We'll bring this money back to the U.S. and invest it here, creating boku jobs, if you give us a sweetheart tax rate on our profits of only about 5%, rather than the usual 35% rate. The Bushites and GOP Congress enthusiastically took the bait. Sure enough, $312 billion came home. But instead of investing it in job creation, top executives and big shareholders simply put it in their pockets. 60% of the boondoggle was gobbled up by only 15 of America's biggest multinationals, many of which actually shut down American plants, fired thousands of workers, and moved more of their production abroad. Merck, for example, brought nearly $16 billion home in October 2005, then announced a restructuring plan the next month to close U.S. plants and cut some 3,500 jobs. You could almost hear the executives chortle and say, "Thanks, suckers." Well, look out, for a corporate lobbying front is working with Republican House leaders to sucker us again. The group includes such super-rich computer giants as Apple, Dell, Google, and Intel, pushing for what they call a repatriation holiday. With a big stage wink, they promise to create jobs in exchange for that same dandy 5% tax deal. This is Jim Hightower saying, "What gross hoggishness! State and national budgets are being slashed, and these fat greedheads are trying to scam America with a tax holiday for themselves." To fight their greed, go to usuncut.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
Thank you. commanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show. I got a
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Footnoted.com reports that James Palmer, the chief financial officer at defense contractor Northrop Grumman, he gleefully pocketed $750,000 in cash from Northrop Grumman to pay for his upcoming personal move from Los Angeles to Northern Virginia. You see, Northrop Grumman, they're shifting their entire corporate headquarters this summer to the well-paved, well-manicured, high-priced suburbs there in Washington, D.C., just so they can get closer to their biggest customer. That's right, the Pentagon. And courtesy of that Pentagon, and of course you and me, the U.S. taxpayers, Mr. Palmer took home $11.4 million, over double the median pay for 2010 for Fortune 500 CFOs. To help foot the bill for his moving expenses, Northrop Grumman lopped off 60 people, so there are 60 jobs now gone, thank you very much. So they will be moving 300 jobs to Washington, D.C., and letting go the 360 that they had in Los Angeles. So, hey, I'm sure you're very happy that that is working out. And I look at this and I go, Northrop Grumman, they're basically an extension of the U.S. government. I mean, without the government, without we the people, without the Pentagon, without our war society, there's no Northrop Grumman. Understand that. There's not. They build planes. They build everything for us. We fund them. So here, you know, at a time when we can least afford it, at a time when the nation can least afford 60 more job losses, they're lopping those people off. But, you know, three quarters of $1 million to their CFO to move his Tinky Toys and his beer can collection. Amazing, amazing stuff. And you look at the numbers that came out today from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Only 18,000 jobs. Unemployment rose to 9.2%. And what we saw is in the manufacturing sector, we only saw 6,000 jobs created, which basically means that sector has stopped generating jobs. And over the past couple of months, you have seen a significant growth. And it could be that manufacturers are uncertain about what the Republican-led hostage situation is going to cause. Because, you know, Republicans love to say, well, there's uncertainty out there, so the job creators, they're holding back. So maybe, little note, you know, what's good for the goose, good for the gander, I guess. Maybe through the, you know, this ransom situation, the job creators are saying, we don't know what the Republicans are going to do next. We don't know if they're going to take the country straight to hell with them. Scott Paul, executive director of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, said that this is a lousy jobs report. Any momentum we've seen in manufacturing has stalled. He says, I think it's fair to say that we are at a crossroads now. Could we be headed toward years of stagnation, or will Washington do what it takes to help spur private sector growth? Which is one, stop this insanity. Two, start investing in infrastructure and jobs and start investing in, people and education, probably something. Scott Paul goes on to say, while the American people want a jobs plan and the data bears out that challenge, Washington seems tone deaf. Making drastic cuts in investment like infrastructure and research will only deepen the job crisis. Remember the pledge? I got it right here. 48 pages, 27 pages of smiling white people, nice pearly white teeth, 21 pages of redundancy, cut and paste, flowery language. Remember that? Remember the big pledge? Remember that? Well, remember last night we talked about the Republicans' big surface transportation bill? $210 billion, lopping off about a third of it, costing us somewhere around 500,000 jobs. Remember that? And I love what John Mica, the chairman of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, said. He said that we can do a lot more with a lot less. Do a lot more with a lot less. Which is why they cut the funding, because he thinks somehow we're going to be able to do a whole bunch of stuff. Now, understand, I've seen studies that say if for every $1 billion we spend on transportation, creates somewhere around 35,000 jobs. Think about that for a second. We need jobs desperately. And look, the president's right. We do. We need to rebuild America. And if you've looked at our infrastructure, there is absolutely no portion of our infrastructure in this country that does not need immediate, dramatic help. And if you look at the report card from 2009, which hasn't gotten any better in the last 2 years, trust me, the American Society of Civil Engineers basically gave us C's and D's in every category. Our infrastructure GPA is a solid D. They say we need a 5-year investment plan of $2.2 trillion. Now, our friend Mr. Micah, his committee put out a plan, not even half that. Somewhere around half that. Our aviation, our airlines, our airports, our runways, D. Bridges, C. Dams, D. Our drinking water, a D minus. Water inlets, D minus. Levees, D minus. Guess we didn't learn from Katrina. Guess we haven't learned from what's been going on in Missouri and across the Midwest. Haven't learned from that. Our roads, a D minus. Our wastewater treatment plants, a D minus. Those are generous. I'm betting today those are all Fs. Because we haven't, since 2009, done much to upgrade that. And, you know, when I look at this, it just drives me absolutely batty that now here we are over two years later, the president's still saying, well, we need to invest in roads and bridges. Well, why the hell didn't he do it back in 2009? Oh, that's right. We had a Republican Party who said no. No. And kept sticking their fingers in their ears and kicking their feet like my 2-year-old does sometimes when she can't have an extra piece of cake. Or when she doesn't want to get into the car seat. And that's basically, we're at the mercy of a 2-year-old. That's what's going on in this country, folks. We're at the mercy of a bunch of 2-year-olds. And we voted them in. Well, I'm sorry, we didn't vote them in. Most of us stayed home and allowed others to vote them in. So I don't know that we can really complain. We're getting kind of, I think, what we deserve. And I'm hoping this is an opportunity, Jake, for people to learn their lesson.
Well, the reason that infrastructure is a favorite target of those who have progressive ideas, and not only because we need it, but you think about that. We build high-speed rail, which we need. You build it, it's creating a lot of jobs, but once it's built, there's additional jobs. Same thing with new airports. A lot of jobs create building it, but once it's built, you also, on top of that, you know, have the cherry on top.
And then
you're going to have long-term employment.
And as a nation, you have that infrastructure to profit from for 50 years.
And high-speed rail will enhance the economy, stimulate the economy.
Oh, you're talking
liberal
gibberish.
No, I'm talking practical economics. Because when you have high-speed rail and you're able to deliver the product quicker, that enhances business. Stimulates the economy. Boy, there's a unique idea.
Light bulb.
You know, again, we need these light bulb moments. We need to go, oh, yeah. Yeah, jobs. Remember those? Remember November 2010? That's all we heard from Republicans. And even John Boehner the other day at the Twitter conference. The president had his little Twitter meeting. Or Twitter hall, however you want to say that. Where are the jobs, Mr. President? Well, sorry, Speaker Boehner. You're the guy who's leading the House there. Why don't you lead and bring a bill to the floor? Oh, that's right. You don't have any ideas. You don't have a clue what to do. All you're hoping to do is make the economy bad enough so that people vote for you because, look, he screwed it up.
Are you telling me that John Boehner lost his laser? He told us that he was gonna zero in like a laser on jobs, jobs, jobs. Apparently somewhere, Rick, he must have misplaced his laser. I don't know. Haven't seen it, John. You know, maybe he misplaced it and put it in the same place where I don't know where he was going for his tans. I don't know. just trying to be funny here, but I can tell you this. John Boehner hasn't created a lot of jobs.
We get the warhead.
With no idea.
We hold the world ransom for $1 million.
Well, don't you think we should maybe ask for more than $1 million? $1 million isn't exactly a lot of money these days.
Well, there's John Boehner. Again, you know, I look at this, and it's the same kind of thing. It's a hostage situation. And our Boehner, not going to lose the opportunity. Let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this. Beat up cars, tires and rubbers go.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
With a PSECU Home Equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to knock items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing light is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseCU.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters? Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again because God is a Republican.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Also, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, go right to the website, and you can download our podcast or go to Apple's iTunes as well. Lots of opportunities there. Interesting statement by Orrin Hatch. And it's one of those things that, you know, kind of makes you, you know, which side are you on? But Orrin had this to say.
And I hear how they're so caring for the poor and so forth. The poor need jobs. And they also need to share some of the responsibility. Now, we don't want the really poor people who are in poverty to have to pay income taxes. But 51% of all households? And that's going up, by the way, because of our friend down in the White House and his allies.
So 51% don't pay any taxes. That's what our buddy Orrin has to say. And, you know, I look at the reality. If you remember last night, we talked about the Tax Policy Center and their claims that somewhere in the neighborhood of 24,000 U.S. taxpayers making over $532,000. You know, these are folks that are in the top 1%. These 24,000 folks are going to pay zero federal income taxes in 2011. Zero. Understand what Orrin is saying here. understand what Mr. Hatch is saying. He wants those 51%. Well, they should be paying. I don't hear him talking about these folks. Now, add that to the reality that the top 400 people in this country, the heavy 400, the big 400, the super, the creme de la creme, the folks right at the cherry on the top of our sundae, if you will. They control more wealth than the bottom half of the country. So you have 400 people, 50% of the wealth. More wealth than 50% of the country. You know, those lazy people who aren't paying taxes. You have 400 people who have more wealth than half of the country. And O-RAN is going, we won't throw that A. Never mind the 400. And it's important because Hatch wants the bottom half to pay, but he wants to allow those at the top to walk away. And, there's part of me that wishes I could do Republican math. Because they look at this, 51% of the people aren't paying federal taxes. Well, what about Social Security? Well, except that. Oh, yeah. 51% of the people aren't paying, and what that equates to is, well, they're not paying taxes. No, they're not paying federal income tax. They're paying Social Security taxes. They're paying a lot of federal excise taxes. They're paying taxes. In fact, they're paying a greater percentage of their taxes, their income in taxes, than those 400. But we don't want to talk about that because, well, that might, because we'll have to face reality. And I look at the Arthur Anderson type accounting that the Republicans love to throw out at us. And our lieutenant governor caught me in an interesting position. He said that, the Marcellus Shale people created 72,000 jobs. Marcellus Shale created 72,000 jobs. And I'm going, if I use that kind of accounting, because understand how he got the 72,000. Every job that they could find that was created, and someone was hired for a job, like the fast food restaurant down the street, they counted as a new hire. Now that guy quit. They hired somebody else. They counted that as a new hire. He quit. They hired another guy. They counted that as a new hire. So if I use Republican math right, I'm a millionaire. Because for the last 20 years, I've made about 50 grand a year. So that I'm a millionaire. Jake, I'm a millionaire! Never mind that I had to pay rent and car payments and food and gas and taxes. And never mind that, I had to, pay for school for the kids and all kind of stuff. Never mind books and all that. Never mind. I made $1 million. I'm a millionaire, according to what my Republican friends say, especially according to our lieutenant governor, who, again, I still think is Mr. Bean. I think he's that guy who just walks around kind of dopey looking, because when he says things like this, makes me think he's really dopey. And I really think we need to organize a trip out to his residence for a swimming today. I'm really thinking that's a good idea, other than the fact that I'd have to see your pasty legs. That would be a bad thing.
Are you insinuating something?
I'm not insinuating anything, I'm saying.
As the Bowery Boys would say, are you dissinuating something?
No, I'm actually saying. But what's interesting to me, and you look at this, and I'm not trying to make light of this. This is how the Republicans work. It's interesting how the numbers play out when they want the numbers to work, and they want a big number like 72,000 new hires in Pennsylvania. They just devise a system to get to that number. There were 72,000 people hired. How can you argue with that? Granted, that one job at the fast food joint hired 60 people in that one position because they couldn't keep them because they were paying crummy wages and crummy conditions and no benefits. And crummy hours probably too. So people had high turnover. But every time somebody was hired for that high turnover job, that's a new hire. And how can you argue with that?
Well, since you got on the subject, I feel free to discuss the Marcellus Shale situation. I mean, the industry is saying, well, we haven't hired a lot of Pennsylvanians because, you haven't trained enough. Well, the stories coming out of western Pennsylvania are that these companies are coming up here with their own people and they're doing regular labor work that doesn't require a lot of training, and they're their own people. But yet, according to the industry, well, we haven't had a lot of Pennsylvanians because they're not qualified.
Well, if you're going to use that argument, I look at the Boeing situation in South Carolina. That, and we're going to talk about that in the next segment with Kenneth Dow Schmidt, professor of labor and employment law at Indiana University. If you look at that scenario, and I was watching a piece on this, that they've actually built this plant, they've hired people, and they are actually training those folks to do those jobs. And really, it's kind of an interesting throwback idea, like we used to when my grandfather and, you know, the generation before me found a job at 18. They were trained. They moved their way up through the company, and they didn't have to go to trade schools or colleges and spend their entire life savings attempting to get an education so that they could serve the company. They actually were trained by the company. And I find it interesting that Boeing is taking the jobs away from an area that has a skilled workforce to do those jobs, putting in an area of very unskilled workforce, and then taking on the costs themselves of training them. And I look at the Marcellus Shale people, there should be an incentive, if corporations are willing to do it, because obviously Boeing is, we should be demanding, if these are high-skilled jobs that our pipe fitters and our construction people can't do, maybe we upgrade their skills on the job training. You know, maybe they've been walking away from paying taxes. We haven't been particularly interested in overseeing them, and we've been more than happy to give them as much land as they want, 700,000 acres of state forest land. So you got to go at some point. Can't we demand something back? Oh, no, we've got a governor bought and paid for. That's right, we can't do that.
I like Democratic candidate Honorado's idea, you know, every time. They apply for a permit. You have language in there which dictates that they will hire a certain number of native Pennsylvanians. But that isn't going to happen under this administration.
Jake, don't you understand? That's tyranny. You're telling a private corporation what they can do?
Well, they have the option of not coming to Pennsylvania. It's pretty clear. You know what I mean? If you wanna come to Pennsylvania, you come to this state under our rules. This isn't the Republic of Natural.
How dare you?
This is the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
How dare you? How dare you say something like that? But you're right, though. You know, we should have the ability to dictate what happens in our state, especially with our resource. And this is the one thing I do give Sarah Palin credit for. She did stand up to the oil people and say, look, it's our oil. We're going to benefit from it. And the people of her state get a check. And it's kind of socialistic if you think about it. It's kind of a socialist move by our ultra-right-wing conservative, former quitter governor, that the people of the state should benefit from the resource that comes out of their ground. Imagine that. And you know what else is an idea? That maybe you should, as a country, have a say in what happens to the workforce. Maybe we should have laws. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Kenneth Schmidt, professor of labor and employment law at Indiana University, about just that. Should we, as a people, should we have the ability to dictate what happens on the job? Should we be able to hold companies accountable for doing things that are against our laws? We'll find out after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425 if you've got a question for the good professor. Back after this.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. In Wisconsin, they had Walkerville. In New York City, Bloombergville. And now in Minnesota, they have Downeyville. The name targets State Representative Keith Downey due to his role in proposing a 15% state employee cut that would see nearly 5,000 lose their jobs. Minnesota's government has been shut down for 8 days, and workers have been gathering daily in hopes legislators will reach an agreement with Governor Mark Dayton. St. Paul City Council Member Melvin Carter spoke on Wednesday.
If they succeed, Their plan would leave us with closed libraries, locked rec centers, fewer police and firefighters, and even higher property taxes than we're already paying today. We deserve better.
Both sides are blaming each other for the shutdown. However, the governor isn't up for re-election until 2014, and many of the Republicans in the legislature are up next year.
We are watching you. There's a report card coming. You better get to work or you won't be coming back. Thank you.
The theme heard in Minnesota echoes the theme throughout the country. Protesting taxpayers want state governments to stop balancing budgets on the backs of low and middle income workers and instead raise taxes on the top 2%. Minnesota AFL-CIO President Shar Knutson.
So their so-called budget plan that would have only balanced the budget on the backs of middle-class families like you and me, and not even that, it would eliminate jobs rather than create the jobs.
390 Blue Cross Blue Shield workers in the Buffalo, New York area are locked out of their jobs despite being willing to work. Hundreds of members of the Office of Professional Employees International Union, Local 212 in Buffalo, New York, are protesting the lockout by HealthNow New York Incorporated, doing business as Blue Cross Blue Shield of Western New York. Dina Fox, business representative of OPEIU Local 212, says the company refused to agree on a fair contract as the union tried to negotiate more job security.
Before we got out of bargaining on that night, our membership received robocalls from their employer telling them not to report for work. This is not a strike. This is a lockout. The workers did not come together and say, we don't want to work. The workers are saying, we want to work and we want a fair collective bargaining agreement.
Fox says 164 positions have been lost at Buffalo's Blue Cross Blue Shield facility in the past 4 years. The union is trying to bring jobs back while the company insists on total outsourcing freedom. Fox says these workers are just middle-class Americans trying to provide for their families.
These are everyday, day-to-day folks trying to pay their bills, make a living, and make sure they can provide for their families.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Instead of talking about how to safeguard the pensions of Americans who've retired or about to retire, the Education Workforce Committee is going to conduct yet another witch hunt designed to prove somehow that the National Labor Relations Board is part of some vast Trotskyite conspiracy to kill jobs in the American workforce. The fact of the matter is, what's killing jobs in the American labor market is the inaction, intention, and ineptitude of the Republican majority.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. And, you know, Rob Andrews is absolutely right. They have built this straw man. And, you know, I got to give them credit. They're brilliant at framing. They're brilliant at messaging. They've taken this situation with Boeing and the NLRB, and it's freedom, it's tyranny. When the reality is, it's about right and wrong. This is about a company who's breaking the law. It's that simple. So the other day they had their little, calling a kangaroo court. They brought in their supporters and one pinata to beat up on that supports what the NLRB is doing and thought they were going to steamroll him. But he did a fantastic job. That's why we've invited him on the program, Professor Kenneth Dow Schmidt, labor and employment law professor at Indiana University. Professor, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick, and thanks for the compliment. I will admit I felt exhilarated, actually, after the hearing. I felt like, you know, the old saying, Churchill, I guess, said there's nothing more exhilarating than being shot at and missed. And, yeah. I'm glad that you agree that they missed.
Absolutely. And, you know, the one thing that caught me is he goes, well, you know, is it okay for me to think about killing somebody? And that whole conversation that went on, and I'm saying, no, you can't say that you're going to kill somebody in public. That's a crime, too.
Yeah, I thought quite kind of bizarre. He was kind of inviting me to say I was going to kill him that afternoon, and I was thinking, surely it's against federal law for someone to threaten a congressman. So I found that kind of a bizarre exchange.
Yeah, I've been in those situations myself where you're the pinata that's supposed to get beat up, and when you come out with all your candy, you feel pretty good about it.
I did feel good about it, and you know, the staff that had helped prepare me and all that, they felt very good about it, too.
As well you should. Here, let's talk about this situation, though. What's going on is Boeing, in my opinion, has broken the law. I think the NLRB, for so long, has not done its job, has been the tool of corporate America, that finally, when they decide to stick up for workers, everyone on the right is just beyond themselves.
Well, and I think we saw that at the hearing, too. I mean, the rules that are proposed, I think, as I said at the hearing, very, very good job of trying to take past practices and take what didn't work in the old rules and update it so that you had a unified, streamlined system of rules that would allow the parties to introduce evidence early and to narrow the issues rather than expand the issues, give employers only one shot at appeal rather than having this two-headed system of appeal that we have now. That really creates a lot of opportunities for abuse, and I really think the board needs to be commended for the work they did. And I said that at the hearing. Wilma Liebman, I've followed her work for years. She's very bright, knows a lot about labor law, very well intentioned. Even one of the Republican witnesses, past chair Schammer, had to admit that she's a very level-headed person and knows what she's doing. I think she's a good civil servant. She's trying to do a good job. She needs to be commended for that, not attacked.
Well, and look, anybody who's going to stand up for working people in this environment, the Republicans are going to attack.
Yeah, I think that's accurate.
But here's the thing. Here's the thing that nobody brought up. And I kept hearing the Republicans going after this time and time again, but employers aren't going to have time to make their case. You know, the unions, they've got all the time. You know, they can go after the workers, and they've got all the time. But employers can't make their case. And I wish someone would have said, wait a second. They have, from the moment they hired that person, to treat them well, pay them well, and give them the respect and dignity that they deserve so that they don't go looking elsewhere.
Well, that's true, and that's putting the positive spin on it. Everybody was thinking about the negative there, and Rick, that's a good insight to think about the positive there. I mean, we talked about, at least I talked about, employers at least have access to employees the entire time they're employed there and can communicate with them, and we talked about the negative, the captive audience speeches and things like that, that none of that is changed by these rules. But you're absolutely right. I mean, if they want to make individual bargaining work, they need to treat workers fairly. And I think that's a good take on it.
Because I've talked to numerous organizers over the years, and they all say the same thing. We've never sold the idea of unions to anyone. They've come to us, and they're the best sales pitch that I'll ever get is a bad employer.
Yeah. I'm sure that's true.
One of the guys that were, one of the congressmen that I thought was most important but seemed very ineffective at saying what he needed to say because he's a little older, was the Michigan congressman who actually remembers Overpass. And I think his insight, to be honest, is something that should be very valuable because he's lived through all of the history of this whole thing.
Yeah, was that Kilder?
It escapes me. I just
I believe it was, but I remember him talking about the history and watching all this. And I believe he also said that his father had been a union member. And actually, I got to tell you, I got the chance to have dinner with my son afterwards because he's working in Washington D.C. right now. And I thought my son had a very good insight, which was. He had listened to it, and he said, you know, a lot of people were mentioning about how their dads had been union members before. And he said, you know, in one generation, they're not going to be able to say that. I mean, that's where we are right now, is that not very many people are going to be able to say, my mom or my dad was a union member.
Yeah, and again, you know, this is that's an excellent insight because, you know, I look at this and it's the same scenario. My grandfather was a union member for most of his working life. I was a union member for most of my working life. I don't see that for my children and most of their friends. I don't see it either. Which is why, you know, again, you look at the rules and how difficult they are. And I've seen campaign after campaign after campaign be stalled, delayed, with, you know, just some of the most abusive, practices going on. And I often ask, why is no one doing anything? Why aren't our laws protecting, workers who do this? Because I think I've seen studies, some 60 million people would join a union tomorrow if they could. It's just that fear factor.
I brought up, facts along those lines at the hearing. There's this empirical paradox that if you compare workers in the United States and Canada, very, very similar countries, similar economies, similar positions in the world, more workers in the United States want unions than workers in Canada do. union. And the only explanation that's been given for that is American law is restricts the right to freely choose a union, and employers can use American law to help keep to force their desires on workers not to have a union. And now what people are going to do about this, I guess it's really just, I've pondered this too, because we are in a real pickle. And I was so hopeful when Obama was elected. I thought, we're going to have a new little mini New Deal or whatever. And then 2010 came. And what people need to do is they need to organize from the ground up. They need to get out and vote, make sure they vote in all elections. They need to, organize, start working at their own workplace about bringing in a union and advocating for unions. I'm going to start, as a professor, I live up in this Ivy Tower, and so I'm kind of removed from it, but I really want to do more things. Like, I'm going to write more op-ed pieces. I'm going to, maybe I'll testify in front of Congress again. I mean, some kind of advocacy is what people have got to do.
Well, I think we need more people taking to the streets and singing the praises. For too long, I think people have gotten complacent. I'm okay. I've got my little piece of the pie. I think we need to be more active. I remember seeing Ralph Reed in an interview talking about the Christian Coalition, and the interviewer asked him, how did you build this empire? How did you build this membership? And he pulled out the Steelworkers Handbook and said, I just followed these principles. We need to go back to that.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Kenneth Dow Schmidt, professor of labor and environmental law at Indiana University. You talked about something that very briefly that caught my attention. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you said something along the lines of the NLRA had some redistributive quality.
Representative Gowdy wanted to say that I had somehow implied that, and that was some horrible thing. It's actually stated right up front in the purposes of the law, especially if you read the legislative history. The National Labor Relations Act was passed as part of the New Deal, and it expressly says it's to promote industrial peace and to promote equality of bargaining power between employers and employees. And when you read the legislative history, this is well-accepted history that I teach every year to my labor law students. The idea was if we give employees a free choice to join a union, many will. And when they negotiate, they will get higher wages and benefits. And this will put money in the working class, in the pockets of working class people, and they will spend money, and this will help us get out of the recession. It was consciously designed as a way to put money into the middle class's hands as a way of getting out of the recession, out of the Great Depression. And that's expressly in the purposes and the legislative history.
So my question then,
there's really no question about
that. Then my question then becomes, given the fact that it was passed when it was, looking at the economic conditions of today, looking at the fact that corporations are sitting on a couple of trillion dollars, looking at the fact that we've got CEOs who are fatter and happier than they've been ever, could we use something like that today?
We certainly could, and actually, it's a two-headed snake. With the way the distribution of wealth has gone, I think it's the top 10% has gotten 59% of the income gains in the last two decades. And the problem with that is that they're floating in money, and they were the ones that engaged in the speculation in the financial markets and the housing markets that caused the financial disaster. They had too much money to do with it, and they ended up putting it into speculation. And now we're left in the recession. We've gotten out of all the recessions in modern time. The way we've been let out of them is by consumption, by middle class spenders and government stimulus. The government spending on either wars or consumption or building up the infrastructure or something. And now, the middle class, who have not gotten the wage increases and are mortgaged to the hilt, they mortgage themselves to the hilt, so they have more debt than they've ever had, cannot spend to help get us out of this recession. So we're just sitting here spinning our wheels. And then when they start laying off public sector workers, that's when the mild recovery we had that was going on, that's when it came to a halt. So no, we do, and that goes along with the consumption too. When you lay off the public sector workers, they don't have money to spend. So now, not only do we have more people unemployed, but we have less aggregate demand. So you're absolutely right that what we need to do is stimulate the economy now. Right now, we need to raise aggregate demand. We could do that through government spending, and particularly on infrastructure, which would leave something for our kids to have, and Lord knows we need to improve our infrastructure. But we could also stimulate the economy by putting monies in the hands of middle-class people and working-class people so that they can consume and buy things for their family and employ other people to produce those things.
Yeah, you know, back in January of 2009, when the president took office, I took a lot of grief for saying that his first bill should have been to pass the Employee Free Choice Act, or at least some sort of strike replacement bill, so that labor has the opportunity to bargain for the gains that were going to come. Instead of being in a position where the gains that have been fought for over the 30 years are being stolen away, and what didn't happen, they didn't pass it, and time again, we keep seeing corporations stealing back wages, raising the cost of health insurance, and workers not having the ability to fight back.
Well, I'll tell you, that's a very clever call, Rick, because in retrospect, that was a lost opportunity, and it's going to be a long time before he gets an opportunity like that again. I really think we need reform of the United States Senate, because it's so easy to block any kind of progressive movement or any kind of national health insurance or anything that we want to do under the system that we currently have, that unless we reform our legislative system, it'll be decades before we get another chance to get labor law reform.
Well, there's part of me that said when the collapse happened that maybe this is that moment where people's stomachs get empty and their heads get right. Unfortunately, that didn't happen.
Yeah.
Last question I've got for you, and it's about the Boeing situation. You know, I've framed this in a way. I mean, the right has framed this as a freedom issue. The tyranny of government telling corporations what they can and can't do. The reality is, this is a company who broke the law. This is a right or wrong thing to me. And I guess the question then becomes: do we have rights as workers, or don't we?
Certainly, you know, if the board and I think the board is very competent to develop this case and do it properly. And if they find that they broke the law, they need to be punished. And the only remedy in the law is the make whole remedy, which is if workers lost jobs because of this, they should get jobs. Maybe the Republicans don't like that, but that's the way the law exists, and that's the law on the books. And the NLRB is right to enforce that law.
There was an awful lot of eye rolling when you said that. In fact, they said, well, you're going to make them close down a $1 billion plant? And your answer was spot on. He said, you know, in Washington, they created 2,000 jobs.
Yeah.
And I thought your answer, well, you know, then there should have been 3,000. I thought that was the right answer.
Yeah.
Good for you. And again, I wanted to take the opportunity to thank you and congratulate you on a job well done for working people in this country. You deserve the praise. Congratulations. We'd love to have you back again.
I appreciate it. And just let me tell you, I really appreciated the communication workers sitting behind me in that room. They weren't the only ones. There were other union people there too. But, you know, it was a Republican committee, and you're right, the deck was stacked against me. And they weren't allowed to make enough much noise because of the decorum in the U.S. Congress. But it was nice to have those people behind me because I felt like I had friends there. It really helped.
Was it as funny as it came across when the lawyer from Jackson Lewis said he wasn't a union buster?
Yeah. People couldn't contain themselves. Even with the rules of decorum, yes, you heard many guffaws at that point. It was pretty funny.
Professor, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Rick.
All right. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
They're back. Citigroup, Coca-Cola, IBM, Merck, and dozens of other major U.S. corporations are back in Washington like hogs at the trough, demanding to be fed another tax boondoggle. This is not the first pig out for these oinkers. In 2005, having stashed huge profits in foreign countries and tax havens, the multinational giants came to Washington offering Congress a heck of a deal. We'll bring this money back to the U.S. and invest it here, creating beaucoup jobs, if you give us a sweetheart tax rate on our profits of only about 5%, rather than the usual 35% rate. The Bushites and GOP Congress enthusiastically took the bait. Sure enough, $312 billion came home. But instead of investing it in job creation, top executives and big shareholders simply put it in their pockets. 60% of the boondoggle was gobbled up by only 15 of America's biggest multinationals, many of which actually shut down American plants, fired thousands of workers, and moved more of their production abroad. Merck, for example, brought nearly $16 billion home in October 2005, then announced a restructuring plan the next month to close U.S. plants and cut some 3,500 jobs. You could almost hear the executives chortle and say, "Thanks, suckers." Well, look out, for a corporate lobbying front is working with Republican House leaders to sucker us again. The group includes such super-rich computer giants as Apple, Dell, Google, and Intel, pushing for what they call a repatriation holiday. With a big stage wink, they promise to create jobs in exchange for that same dandy 5% tax deal. This is Jim Hightower saying, "What gross hoggishness! State and national budgets are being slashed, and these fat greedheads are trying to scam America with a tax holiday for themselves." To fight their greed, go to usuncut.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Where common sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
Well, the Rockefellers are back in the news. It seems as though Mark Rockefeller, you know, one of the billionaires you don't hear much about. He's the son of Nelson Rockefeller, and of course the great-grandson of John D. Rockefeller. But he's a bit of a farmer, lives in New York City, has a farm in Idaho, evidently, or at least that's what the government thinks. The government thinks that he's a farmer, and fact of the matter is the government has been paying Mr. Rockefeller not to farm. They don't want him to be a farmer. They prefer him to be a billionaire, but he's not a farmer. So they're paying him not to farm. And for not farming, our Rockefeller has been awarded with $330,000 in subsidies not to farm the Idaho farm, which is actually billed as one of the world's premier fly fishing retreats that cost visitors somewhere around $500 a day. So we're giving him $330,000 in subsidies, while at the same time we are cutting $500,000 in federal funding for food banks in northern Idaho, where this farm is. So I guess the message is it's good to be rich, and screw you for being poor. At least that's the message I get. If you get something different, I would love to hear it. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You know, it's one of those moments where you go, duh, how'd we do that? Well, they've got lobbyists, and lots of them. And it's just an amazing thing. But when we were talking with the good professor, you know, one of the things I didn't hone in on, there is a congressman from Michigan, and his name escapes me, but he's like 90 years old. He was like 80 some years old. He was a kid during the Battle of Overpass, the General Motors sit down strike and all of that. He remembers all that history. He was a part of all that. He saw the movement of a working class from poverty to middle class. And, you know, the guy's like, you know, I saw it all happen. And it was because of the ability of workers to come together and say, you know what? We want some of the profit that we generate. No more. We just want a reasonable share. And that's really what this entire thing is about. And I got to be honest, there's part of me that thinks the Republicans have overplayed their hand yet again in bringing this up. It was a dead issue. Most people didn't even know what the National Labor Relations Board was. Nobody could tell you what the NLRB was or what the NLRA was. This is an education opportunity, and this is where labor really has to get out and begin to explain its history, because the professor's right, his kid's right. You know, in a generation, there's going to be nobody left saying, yeah, my dad's a union member. And what I'm saying in the generation, there's going to be very few kids who can look back and say, we're in the middle class and my dad works for a living. Most people are going to be going, well, you know, the cupboards are bare and we're begging for change on the corner. That's the reality of it. And I had to get into the fact that, look, there was a redistributive quality to the NLRA. And if you remember, Jake, and you were sitting there when I said it, January of 09, first bill should have been the Employee Free Choice Act. Mm-hmm. And for the exact reason that I said, it's going to give people the opportunity to bargain for the wage gains that they're going to be able to get through all of the money that's going to be thrown in. They're going to get a piece of the pie. And it didn't happen. A missed opportunity. And now look where we are. Frustrating stuff. News. Did you see the news today? University of Pitt. I know our chief executive over here at the board, a graduate of the University of Pittsburgh. And fortunately, he's done now.
Actually, I did see it.
8.5% tuition increase. That's for in-state students. The guy's saying, well, you know, we got a 19% reduction in state funding. 19% right across the board. Snap. Gone. So they're going to make it up where? Well, kids are going to pay higher. They're going to pay a higher tuition fee. And again, you know, what bothers me is more and more what we're doing is we're putting the ability to work yourself out of poverty and into the middle class or into the lower part of the middle class upward. We're moving that opportunity further and further away. And the kids that do go to college and do take out these loans are going to be saddled for years. All because we've got a federal government that's walking away from its responsibility and a state government that's walking away from its responsibility to these universities. I go back to my friend she's a professor. She's about, I'd say she's probably about 10 or 12 years older than I am. She's probably in her mid to late 50s. She worked her way as a waitress through the University of Michigan, undergrad and law school. No loans. Working a minimum wage waitress job, and she lived in her own apartment. She was able to do that on a minimum wage job in the late 60s, early 70s. In the early 70s. A minimum wage job as a waitress. She was able to pay her tuition all the way through to get her law degree. No student loans. None of that. See, that's back when we valued education. And we valued opportunity, and the working class saw the value in it. They wanted their kids to be college graduates, and they wanted their kids to do better. And they were willing to put a little bit more tax money into it. And I've talked about this in the past. You know, the 1950s, you know, for all the Norman Rockwell paintings and all the wonder, we in the working class paid higher taxes. Now, the very wealthy paid much higher taxes. The very top marginal tax rate was 92%. But you move your way down hundreds of brackets because it went up by $2,000 up until about 10, then went up by 6,000. There were a bunch of brackets. So the more you made, the more you paid. And that money went back into society and built universities, built world-class education, built world-class infrastructure. What happened to that? Well, what happened? We became the society of me. What about me? We became the individual. And you can thank the whole movement that put Reagan into office. You know, a lot of people blame Reagan for that. I don't give him that much power. He was just the figurehead. He was the puppet at the end of the string that the billionaire class manipulated and were able to put him into power. It was the real people, the real money that put him into that.
You talked about the 50s, and, you know, I remember watching the Nelson family, Ricky Nelson, who eventually became a famous citizen, a famous singer. But I lived in the classic blue-collar, working-class neighborhood, and all the fathers went to work, and all the mothers stayed home. Why? Because most of those men had union jobs, making decent wages, family-sustaining jobs. They could get by with one income. In most instances, that's not true anymore. The 50s came out of World War II. In the 50s, union membership exploded. Now, it reached zenith, I believe, in the 60s. But there was a lot of good things about the 50s, and one of them was that you had good-paying jobs, and fathers could go out and work, and the mothers stayed home and raised the kids. I lived through it.
But people invested in education. And now you look at a new study out in the American Journal of Public Health, put out late last month. that says one of the best ways to save American lives in this country, one of the best ways to make sure that we save kids, good education, reduce racial segregation, combat poverty and income inequality. Sounds pretty reasonable to me. In comparison, according to the data from the Federal Bureau of Investigation's Uniform Crime Report, 15,517 Americans were murdered the same year. That means that nearly 15 times as many Americans died because they failed to achieve adequate levels of education than were killed in horrible homicides. They're saying 245,000 Americans died in the year of 2000 as a result of low education. And you look at this and you go, you know, education, that's the way we get out of this. We fight poverty, get people jobs. Income equality, something we need to work on. Even people like Zbigniew Brzezinski saying, look, you guys got some real problems in the U.S. You have massive gulfs between have and have not. And we do. So the answer, I guess, the way the Republicans see it, and you see a study like this, and you go, well, yeah, makes sense. You need educated people who see a future. You need educated people who will do the right thing, be part of society, get a job, contribute. So what are the Republicans saying? Good education. So we can increase defense and we can increase the prison budget. Yeah, that sounds reasonable, doesn't it? Sounds like a good thing. Give the Pentagon a whole bunch of money. And then you look at this this settlement that just happened. This Armor Group North America Incorporated, or AGNA, one of these, you know, these defense contractors. They just paid a settlement claim of $7.5 million back to the Justice Department, to the Pentagon, to settle claims that in 2007 and 2008, AGNA had actually they had actually charged the U.S. government for their guards going to brothels.
Nice.
And again, you know, I look at this and I go, at some point, do we not look at what's going on in Afghanistan and Iraq and go, you know what, we're just throwing a whole bunch of money down a rat hole, especially when we're paying people to go to hookers. And we're paying a lot of money. And, you know, the $7.5 million fine, I'll guarantee it was probably five or six times more than that.
And I guess we paid for the STDs, too.
Of course we did. Of course we did.
Really nice.
There you go.
Only in America.
Well, and it's all part of this massive budget, and the House just passed a $649 billion defense bill today for the next year. The vote was 336 to 87. It's going to raise the Pentagon's base budget for 2012, beginning October 1st, by about $17 billion over the current level. So we're increasing the Pentagon budget. $530 billion of that will go to the Pentagon's primary budget, which we don't have a breakdown for. And another $119 billion will go for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And that stands as something important because that never happened during the Bush years. We borrowed all that money for Afghanistan and Iraq, which is why they had to raise the debt limit so often. Because they didn't budget for it. They had massive budget deficits. But they borrowed all the money for Afghanistan and Iraq. These numbers that I've laid out for you, they don't include the some $33 billion in other defense spending that we're going to be throwing into nuclear weapons programs and more military construction. But the House, you know, the House measure has its toys. There's some toys for folks. So, you know, the congressman got their stuff. Like almost $6 billion to buy 32 Lockheed Martin radar-evading F-35 joint striker fighters, $15 billion to build 10 Navy ships, $3.5 billion for 28 Boeing F-18 Super Hornet fighter jets, and 12 EA-18 Growler electronic warfare aircraft. So lots of toys. Lots of things to go boom. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We are right back after this.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have a box for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair
Service. Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We are AFSCME.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
I'm just an average man with an average life. I work from 9 to 5. Hey, hell, I pay the price. All I want is to be left alone in my average home. But why do I always feel like I'm in the twilight zone? And I always feel like somebody's fine to me.
1-888-5. Rick, 1-888-520-7425. You know, here's the thing. This is what gets me. You know, you see these numbers where the middle class has stagnated and actually wages have actually gone down over the last 30 years. And you keep seeing these reports like the one today in USA Today where, you know, these CEOs are just making huge amounts of money. In fact, like the one guy said, you know, some of the gains we're seeing are humongous, well beyond what any rational person could ever justify. Like the guy, John Hammergren, McKinsey Corporation, a healthcare service CEO, pulling in $150.7 million. Going, really? $150 million? And most of it were stock options. He's going to pay 15% tax on that. You look at Ralph Lauren, the guy who, the CEO of you know, the big clothing, whatever it is they do, fashion, whatever, over $75 million. And I'm going, you know what? That's just obscene. Just plain obscene. Especially when you look at the reality of the guy who's out there busting his butt, building a house or working on an assembly line or driving a police car or working, you know, hanging on the back of a fire truck, is making in the $40,000-$50,000 range and are being begrudged, especially the state and the public service workers, these people who are beaten constantly by the right, this begrudging them of any sense of being able to support themselves. And I go back to that story my friend who was a teacher always told me. She goes, look, you know, when we were starving, everyone loved us. As soon as we wanted to make a living, that's when the public turned. You know, when little Johnny and Susie brought us an apple every day, ooh, they loved us. They brought us apples. But when we said we wanted a pear, they weren't so thrilled. And, you know, you look at the numbers again, time and time again. You look at the amount of money that is concentrated in the hands of the very few. The fact that we have got people like Larry Ellison, the CEO of Oracle, or the guy that Bezos guy from Amazon, or Warren Buffett, who between the three of them, they saw their net worth increase by $13 billion in 1 year. And for that increase, they're going to pay about $1.9 billion, 15%. Now, you and me, we go to work, we swing a hammer, we pay more than that. And remember that guy I was talking about, the lottery winner? The guy who maybe took the last 20 bucks, the food, the money he should have put on the table for food to feed his family? Let's say he won the mega lottery. Let's say he won the big game. He was the big winner. Let's say he won the $13 billion that the three of those guys put in their pocket. He'd pay 25%. 25%. Or $3.25 billion. Explain to me the difference again, because I'm not getting it. Explain to me the difference of gambling on Wall Street or gambling at the convenience store. And for you and me, if we somehow were able to work and bust our behind and make $13 billion in a year, which is never going to happen, we pay over $4.5 billion in taxes because we worked for it. And again, you know, I go back to the whole conversation I had back January of 2009. What I wanted for this president, and I will say it again and I will continue to say it, is that he is the guy that we look back on and say he's the guy who rewarded hard work. He's the guy who made work pay. And he just has not done that. And we continue to pander to Wall Street. We continue to allow them to have these lucrative schemes and their well-stocked shelves, and while the rest of us are struggling. It's angering and it's frustrating, Jake.
Absolutely right. If I can make a comment on when you talked about public employees, they did it again, and the right has been so effective in saying over and over again as a reason to privatize some of the services that are done by public employees. Well, you know, those public employees, they make a lot more than people doing the same job in the private sector, which just isn't true. It's an absolute fallacy. And as we reported here in this show a couple times, as the qualifications as far as education and training go up, the differential in pay widens and widens and widens. The end of the day, those in the private sector, when you compare the exact job in the public sector, those in the private sector make more. That's just a fact. But yet, the right wing would have you believe that these public employees are ripping you off.
Well, the reality is, and I go back to when we were in Wisconsin. When I went and got my oil change, and there was that guy in front of me who he was retiring from state government and going to take a private sector job doing the exact job he was doing because they were getting rid of that department or getting rid of that work, and they were privatizing it, and he was actually going to make twice as much in the private sector doing the exact job he was doing for the state. And the guy that behind the counter was ticked off that he was taking his retirement because he was going to retire and then do the job. So he was not only going to get his retirement, he was going to get double the pay. And the guy behind the counter was ticked off that, how could he get his retirement and still go work? And I said, why aren't you upset that they privatized the job that's not costing you twice as much to have done? And again, it's just how you look at things.
That's right.
You look at this Boeing situation. The right has framed it as, well, it's tyranny. How could you tell a company what to do? And I keep saying, folks, this is a country of, for, and by we the people. We should be able to tell corporations what the hell they're doing. Sorry, it's our country, we the people. And if we have laws on the books that say, you know what, workers have the right to strike, workers have the right to strike. And if you come out and say we're retaliating against them in violation of the law and we're going to do it no matter what you say, you have broken the law. It's wrong. And the penalty is what the penalty is. Sorry, you go to jail. Or in this case, you make those people whole. And again, I guess what it is we have been so disconnected from ourselves. And then you give the credit to the right. They've done a very good job of disconnecting workers from their unions, citizens from their government. They've done a very nice job of slicing and dicing us and dividing us up into subgroups and sections and subsection A. And they've done such a great job that I think most of us, we're easily manipulated.
Well, what they've done, right, they've taken your eye off the real culprit, which is the uneven distribution of wealth in this country. It's easy. It's much easier for them to have you believe, well, it's that state worker or it's that teacher or those who are government employees. Look, I've known a lot of people that work for the Pennsylvania state government doing absolutely fundamental jobs that keep our state government working in many instances, which makes us a civilized and more just society, and not getting paid all that much. If I told our listeners, I'm not going to get into the exact numbers, but I was very surprised at how little some of these people make who do fundamental, absolutely jobs that very much need to be done.
State workers on average make $34,000 a year. That's on average. You know, is that a lot of money?
Some of them make a lot less.
I don't think so. That's not a lot of money. But when you look at Wall Street, you look at the message makers, you look at people like Felipe Duman, chief executive of Viacom, $84.5 million last year. You look at Les Moonves, CBS, $56.9 million. You look at the guy who is the head of DirecTV, Michael White, almost $33 million. You look at Obama's new friend there, Brian Roberts of Comcast, $28 million. The guy who runs Disney, Iger, $28 million. These are the message makers. Do they identify with you? I mean, look at those people on TV, the talking heads. They're not making $50,000, $60,000. They're making millions of dollars. Just that simple. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're going to take a quick break, pay some bills. We're right back after this.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers, in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My caseloads are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job, they're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse. Because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Speaking of down, 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 Michelle Bachmann has come out and signed a pledge, another pledge created by the Family Leader, a conservative Iowa-based Christian group that opposes same-sex marriage, Sharia law, and pornography. According to her pledge, she now supports banning all pornography. So there you go. What I find interesting is, you know, it kind of took off and people are saying, well, you know, did she really ban pornography? Well, according to the pledge. I mean, if you look at what this bizarre pledge is, you know, it is what it is. It's a whole bunch of these really bizarre kind of statements that just, like the one that caught my attention was, it said slavery had disastrous impact on African American families. Yet sadly, a child born into slavery in the 1860s was more likely to be raised by his mother and father in a two-parent household than was an African American baby born in the election of the first U.S. African American president. And I look at that, I go, well, probably because they were slaves and they couldn't get away from each other and they were stuck in the same house. That would be my first thought. They didn't have a choice. There was no choice there. None whatsoever. But that's a whole other discussion. But they go on to talk about, you know, just bizarre things. You know, you're going to ban all forms of pornography and prostitution and infanticide and abortion and types of coercion and stolen innocence. And they really, I mean, if you read, it's 8 pages long. And I spent a couple hours reading through it and kind of, you know, going looking at some of their other stuff. And it's really just creepy, creepy stuff. But then again, these Christian people, these extremists, these people who scare me more than Bin Laden ever did, it's what I expect from them. And don't fret. Tricky Ricky Santorum joined on. He signed the pledge as well. He is now a signator to the pledge, and he vows to uphold the institution of marriage as being only between one man and one woman, and, of course, committing himself to the other 14 specific steps. And I thought, you know, being a Christian group, they should have limited it to 10. You know, just kind of keeping it uniform. Would have made better sense to me. Also, you know, they're against homosexuality, which is another one of those things that they seem to be obsessed with. So good for them. But here's something that I think both Michelle and Tricky Ricky would be really in favor of. In Russia, they have the highest divorce rate in the world. They also have a low birth rate. So they celebrated their 4th annual Day of Married Love and Family Happiness. That was today. So the 4th annual Day of Married Love and Family Happiness. So they're really trying to push this stay married thing, be happy, kind of same kind of brainwashing thing. So good for them. Hope it works. You know, look, hey, you know, I want everybody to be married. I want people to have, you know, children and do that whole procreation thing and be the Leave It to Beaver family that they can be. The reality is very few Leave It to Beaver families exist. Most of them are Roseanne. Most of them are dysfunctional and weird and bizarre, and they have their quirks. But whatever gets them through the day, man. On Wednesday, our boy Tricky Ricky, the presidential candidate, he's also called for reductions. Along with calling for the end of pornography, he wants to end, he wants to reduce federal funding of higher education. According to the Daily Iowan, which is the University of Iowa's student newspaper, they said former U.S. Senator Rick Santorum on Wednesday said the federal government should reduce higher education funding and leave that support to the states. Apparently, Tricky Ricky has not been in Pennsylvania lately. You see, we got a governor across the road here who wanted to cut higher education by 56%. Actually, come to think about it, I actually doubt that he's been anywhere. I don't think he's been out of his crazy cocoon because most states are walking away from the next generation and gutting education at all levels. And like I said earlier, the University of Pittsburgh raising their tuition 8.5%. Temple, they're going to increase 10%. Your Penn State, tuition rates through the roof. In fact, one of the most expensive in the country.
The most expensive.
The most expensive.
That's
more
what
expensive,
they announced. That's
more expensive
what...
than Harvard or Yale?
No, State University.
Well, but they're not
the most
university.
Well, they are. But they call it. That's. It's called Pennsylvania State University.
Yeah, but they're more private than they are. I don't know.
No, it's called the Pennsylvania State University. That was the press release last week. Penn State is now the most expensive in the country. And at one time, it was very, very low. Thank you, Governor Corbett.
And now you've got, well, you know, that's not him who caused it to go all the way to the top. He helped. He was helping along the way. This is years of walking away from education.
Yes.
This is years of turning our back on students. Not just at the higher education level, K through 12 as well. But again, you know, it comes back down to politicians who want to have those, hey, I didn't raise your taxes moment. Vote for me. I'm not going to raise your taxes. And then you look at what they've done. What have you done? Oh, well, we ruined education. We've ruined the infrastructure. And we've allowed jobs to be outsourced out of the country and gave tax breaks to corporations who did it. And we did all these things because we wanted to get reelected.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Michelle Bachmann has come out and given a response. Remember last night we talked about Tim Pawlenty's advisor who had to come out and apologize. And again, I still don't know exactly why he had to apologize for saying that she had sex appeal. I've been saying that every night for the last couple of years. She does. She's hot. For being 55 years old, yeah. Her response.
Go ahead.
Her response is, well, listen, I'm 55 years old. I've given birth to 5 kids, and I've raised 23 foster kids. So it sounds like good news to me. And that's her response. And good for her, you know. Good for her for, you know, taking it the way it was meant to be. Maybe she's not a robot after all.
Well, not only is she an attractive, she's an attractive candidate. You have to give her credit. You and I, 90% of her positions we disagree with, but she handles herself well. She really speaks to the crowd. She really
when
speaks,
she's scripted.
She speaks to her base. And in the context of her own political world, she does a good job. Is she gonna win the presidency of the United States? I don't think she has she doesn't have a very good chance of that happening. But there are certain things she does well. And even Bill Clinton, who may be the best pure politician in the last 30 years in politics in this country, even said so.
Well, then it must be true.
Did Ed
Schultz say it?
Well,
it would then
come
be,
on now,
it would be
Rick.
It would be a twofer.
Bill Clinton has done things I don't like. Bill Clinton has done things you don't like. But I do respect his ability as a politician.
Absolutely.
He was very effective.
Yes, he was. But here's the thing. When she's on message, you're right. She's almost unstoppable. But, boy, when she has to speak, other than the cue cards, it's almost like Sarah Palin, who evidently the folks of Alaska have had enough of. They have a somewhat or very negative view of her. 49% of registered Alaskan voters have either had somewhat or a negative view of her. Only 39% have a positive opinion. So they pretty much, you know, her home state, they've had enough of her.
But why would that be? Just because they figured out that all this nonsense about, you know, she's quitting as governor because she wants to serve the country was really an effort on her part to make a lot of money? I think a lot of people figured that out.
Make a lot of money.
I know she did.
She made tons of money.
And that was her, I think that was her endeavor in the first place. And I think from time to time, she shows up, it kind of like, you know, she jumps out of her box. And I guess she misses the limelight, and every now and then she pops up. Just so people don't forget her, so they buy her book. You know, that's basically exactly what she
did. Hey, look at me! Look at me!
Yes,
over here!
That's exactly right.
And, you know, here's the thing. And you know, at the end of it, who's the dumb one? We are, because we still keep talking about her. She's a non-entity at this point. I hope she runs. I want her to jump into it.
I mean, your girlfriend has stolen a lot of her limelight, let's be honest. Michelle.
Michelle. My
bell.
Anyway,
we've got.
All right. Yeah, who sings that song?
The Beatles.
Let's keep it that way. And then now we're going to have to pay them royalties.
Does that mean you're not endorsing me as a singer?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
What we've got is we've got the interview from Professor Dow Schmidt up on our site at therickSmithShow.com if you want to go back and take a look at that. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, you can download our podcast at therickSmithShow.com. If you want to email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com, I do answer all emails. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Richard Vogel, a reporter and editor at CombatingGlobalization.com. Back after this.
You know, in order to get the urge, it's all right.
Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. In Wisconsin, they had Walkerville. In New York City, Bloombergville. And now in Minnesota, they have Downeyville. The name targets State Representative Keith Downey due to his role in proposing a 15% state employee cut that would see nearly 5,000 lose their jobs. Minnesota's government has been shut down for 8 days, and workers have been gathering daily in hopes legislators will reach an agreement with Governor Mark Dayton. St. Paul City Council member Melvin Carter spoke on Wednesday.
If they succeed, their plan would leave us with closed libraries, locked rec centers, fewer police and firefighters, and even higher property taxes than we're already paying today. We deserve better.
Both sides are blaming each other for the shutdown. However, the governor isn't up for re-election until 2014. Many of the Republicans in the legislature are up next year.
We are watching you. There's a report card coming. You better get to work or you won't be coming back. Thank you.
The theme heard in Minnesota echoes the theme throughout the country. Protesting taxpayers want state governments to stop balancing budgets on the backs of low and middle income workers and instead raise taxes on the top 2%. Minnesota AFL-CIO President Shar Knutson.
So their so-called budget plan that would have balanced, would only balance the budget on the backs of middle-class families like you and me, and not even that, it would eliminate jobs rather than create the jobs.
390 Blue Cross Blue Shield workers in the Buffalo, New York area are locked out of their jobs despite being willing to work. Hundreds of members of the Office of Professional Employees International Union, Local 212 in Buffalo, New York, are protesting the lockout by Health Now New York Incorporated, doing business as Blue Cross Blue Shield of Western New York. Dina Fox, business representative of OPEIU Local 212, says the company refused to agree on a fair contract as the union tried to negotiate more job security.
Before we got out of bargaining on that night, our membership received robocalls from their employer telling them not to report for work. This is not a strike. This is a lockout. The workers did not come together and say, we don't want to work. The workers are saying, we want to work if we want a fair collective bargaining agreement.
Fox says 164 positions have been lost at Buffalo's Blue Cross Blue Shield facility in the past 4 years. The union is trying to bring jobs back while the company insists on total outsourcing freedom. Fox says these workers are just middle-class Americans trying to provide for their families.
These are everyday, day-to-day folks trying to pay their bills, make a living, and make sure they can provide for their families.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
We're fighting for is to keep the border closed. I got to be honest. I think this cross-border trucking thing, bad idea. But the Obama administration has signed some intent that we're going to open up the border and allow Mexican domiciled truck drivers into the U.S. Oregon Representative Peter DeFazio has introduced a bill designed to prevent the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration from spending federal highway dollars to purchase electronic onboard recorders for Mexican trucks. Here's the thing. I mean, what I'm told so far, what I'm seeing is we're going to pay for the onboard recorders. We're going to pay for the monitoring. We're going to pay for the drug testing. We're going to pay for the licensing. Supposedly, we're paying for it all. And according to DeFazio, it's an outrage that taxpayers are being told to foot the bill for the Mexican trucking industry to comply with American standards. And the congressman also wonders if DOT has the authority to implement such a cross-border program. But to talk about this program in general, what this is going to mean for the country, what this is going to mean as we move forward, my good friend Richard Vogel, political reporter and editor of the great website CombattingGlobalization.com. Richard, thanks for taking time for us.
Good evening, Rick. How you doing up there?
I am good, and I'm getting better every day because I'm seeing a groundswell of people standing up and fighting back against stuff just like this. I got to be honest. I'm pretty upset by the fact that this president, a Democrat again, jabbing me in the back.
Absolutely. To start off with, though, I want to call you down off of a myth, okay? I'd like to call attention to this article that I've got posted on my website. It's called Offshoring U.S. Transportation Jobs in Mexico, The Looming Deadline. In there, I talk about the myth of the Mexican carriers, okay? And I think that what everybody needs to understand to begin with, and I've got the history of this. I started this in 2006. We defeated this one time down here on the Texas end of this transportation corridor, is that it's the transnational corporations using Mexican drivers in their fleet trucks that are about to take over. So think Walmart. Walmart is in the process of moving their distribution centers across border into Mexico because they're going to discharge half of their drivers, is my estimate, and hire Mexican drivers to drive the Kmart, the Walmart trucks.
And the Kmart and the Target and all of them. And that's exactly a point that I've been making. And thank you for making it crystal clear. Because what my fear has been, and a lot of the communities in this area have been building these huge warehouses, I'm saying a lot of those warehouses are going to close and end up south of the border.
The irony in this, Rick, that nobody seen, one of the ironies of this is that down here in Texas where the huge distribution centers are, like in Baytown, Texas, that hires a lot of undocumented immigrants here in the United, you know, here in Texas to work in the distribution center. That's the biggest Walmart distribution center right now is in Baytown, Texas. The undocumented immigrants are going to go home and work for Walmart in Mexico as soon as the drivers are allowed to cross the border. It's all about the cost of drivers. I haven't heard anything from the Teamsters about it this time. In 2006, we heard from the Teamsters, and we heard from, we heard a lot from environmental groups, about the trucks weren't going to be safe and the safety issues. In this last article I wrote, I said people are going to see Mexican drivers driving trucks made in Mexico, delivering goods made from the Orient in Mexico, you know, all the way across the United States. I mean, right now in Mexico, the truck fleets, like Walmart's truck fleet that's stationed and that they're shaping up in Mexico, is newer and safer and burns cleaner than their truck fleet here in the United States.
Yep, and that's one of the Teamsters have been out. It's just that nobody's been covering it. The Teamsters have been out there saying, you know, hey, this is a bad idea. It's bad for the economy. It's bad for the environment. It's bad for the safety on the roads. It's bad for a whole bunch of reasons. But you've made the point that I've been making in the flaw in the Teamsters' argument of safe trucks is that the American companies and the multinationals are going to put all brand-new fleets down there, and then where's your argument? To me, it's all about economics. To me, it's all about controlling your border. I mean, this is a country that's in the middle of what I would say is a civil war.
Well, I think that we need to keep in mind here that this is part of a movement that's been going on for a long time. This started with NAFTA, and the trucks were held back, and this trucking thing was held back, but we had the offshoring, and now we have this onshoring of drivers into the United States. And again, it's always, you know, to undercut wages up here. I was doing a little work on the Owner Operators Independent Drivers Association. These guys carry a lot of the freight that's going to be taken up now by the Mexican drivers when they start moving. See, again, though, we can't look at the Mexican drivers. We have to look at the transnational corporations. And here's how important this issue really is. In 2006, there was I've got another article linked in this first article. My first article was on the NAFTA corridors and offshoring transportation jobs in Mexico. They were developing this new superport in Punta Colinet in Baja. They were just breaking ground on it. And the idea was to land these super container ship carriers in this new port, bring them across the Juarez Mountains into the middle of the Sonora Desert, and then hook up at Highway 8, which splits off, of course, at I-10 can go up to Phoenix, or it can go into the Eastern Distribution.
The reason that, and that would have been Punta Colinet was going to be, and they claimed it was going to be, the future Mexican Long Beach. So they were going to divert all of this freight and all of this merchandise around Long Beach into Mexico, just 120 miles south of the border, and then bring it in. And the whole idea was contingent on Mexican drivers. We were talking about a couple billion dollars that they were going to dredge out this channel big enough to take these ships and everything. It's in the middle of the desert. They were going to have to build the whole infrastructure at the time. But the whole thing was contingent on Mexican drivers doing the driving. So in 2007, when the first driving program was defeated, the financier said, no, we're not going to do this. We're not going to do this unless we can have Mexican drivers. That's how absolutely important it is for these people to keep wages down.
Yep.
So if this goes through, not only are we going to lose the drivers and the owner-operators that are doing it now and the freight that's already coming in through the Mexican ports, and we have Mexican ports in Manzanillo and Lazaro Cardenas, they're going to have all this stuff in Punta Colinet, and Punta Colinet's supposed to bring in, like, by 2025, they say there was supposed to be 6 million containers landing there per year.
Wow.
So all the future business is gone, too, plus all of the distribution and assembly that's located in California now in the inland, what's called the Inland Empire, that serves Long Beach and L.A., is going to be moved to Punta Colinet. So we're talking about tens of thousands of transportation jobs, and we're talking about more tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of support jobs and warehouse jobs to go along with it. So the next thing we're going to hear about is Punta Colinet being started up again if this program goes through.
Well, what do you say to those, and just to play devil's advocate here for a second, what do you say to those people? Well, American drivers can go down into Mexico. This is a cross-border situation. We're on equal footing. We'll be able to go into Mexico, and they can come across. And it's just exchanging drivers in that vein. What do you say to that?
But the majority of the freight moves north.
See, because I don't. But here's the problem. I don't see any American drivers going into Mexico for a whole litany of reasons. One, you've got a whole bunch of unrest. Two, there's a legal structure difference. And three, who's going to drive down there safety wise? And you get into trouble down there. You think our State Department is going to come help you out?
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, but what you need to keep in mind is that the TNC trucks, the Transnational Corporation trucks, like from Monterrey, have got their own private freeway that they get to Laredo, Nuevo Laredo, and cross over. In fact, the roads down there are better than the roads in South Texas. And this infrastructure was already built. And I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theory nut, but you've heard talk about the drones down here that are flying over Mexico. They're flying over the freeway to make sure that the maquiladoras, you know, the U.S.-owned maquiladoras are safe and their drivers are safe. But they still, you know, I mean, if you wanted to go and bid, if you were an American driver and you wanted to go bid against one of these contract haulers in Mexico, it's going to be the same thing that happened in construction, the same thing that happened everywhere else. You can't afford, you know, to bid against somebody like that, especially owner-operators, when you're buying your own fuel and paying your own taxes. So there's a lot of straw dogs that are put up here, you know. Personally, I think that the militarization of the border is kind of on purpose to intimidate drivers not to go down there, too. They don't want it to be safe for American drivers to go across. The only people that are going to pass through safely and guaranteed are trucks. And it doesn't matter whether they're Mexican drivers. Trucks that are branded by the TNCs, the Transnational Corporation.
Right.
So if you have a Walmart truck, no matter who's driving it, and of course it's going to be the cheapest driver that drives it. Everybody in transportation business knows that. Being looked over by a predator drone, you know, and going to be, they're putting in a new bridge at Laredo so that they can move straight through without stopping at the border for inspections or anything else. So the same people that we need to watch here, we working people, and we don't like to do this. We're kind of lazy. We like to watch the surface, you know. The same people that write these bills and write these memos of understanding stuff are the same people that write legislation in the United States. Watch the economic gain. Rick, you're absolutely right about that. Watch, follow the money. Okay? Connect the dots, follow the money, and you'll find out what it is.
So how do we stop this, Richard Vogel? Again, the website, combatingglobalization.com. We've got a link at our site at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Richard's name. It'll take you right there. What do we do? How do we stop this? Where do we go? Because it seems to me it's a done deal.
Well, I think they're scared. I don't think it's a done deal. They tried this in Texas in 2006. They were, of course, we had a little bit more leverage then because communities where these NAFTA corridors were going to cut through, it's called the Trans-Texas Corridor, which is a 1,200-foot wide corridor. You can get all the details in my original article about this. We're going to cut through communities. So communities were out too, saying, you know, we don't need our kids, you know, eating all this diesel dust. You know, no, you're not coming through here. And the state of Texas went crazy, sent out teams to try to get people to, you know, to manufacture some kind of consensus and everything. One of the reasons I set up Combating Globalization in 2000, my website, was to start a dialogue about what's successful. I have articles in there where I talk about how in the Texas area we stopped the Trans-Texas corridors and how we had these coalitions to move into it. We need to start thinking differently about this. You know, like, we can't count on the Teamsters to do it. We can work with the Teamsters, but the Teamsters don't haul that freight anymore. It's owner-operators. So, number one, I would say, you know, support these people, which is the Owner-Operators Independent Drivers Association. I have got a link to this in my article.
We've had them on the program a number of times.
Yeah, they filed lawsuits. They could use help. They could use publicity. They could use money to follow their lawsuits. Encourage unions to look at the independent owner operators and to form links. We need to think of some new kinds of strategies. I think one of the main things we need to do is to get a unified vision about what's going on.
You need to start organizing people. You know, one of the things that I've been talking about is, you know, in Europe, what you see is a situation like this comes up. You see truck drivers turning the trucks on sideways on the roads. Maybe this is going to be that moment in the industry where finally you find some solidarity. Finally, you find some will. You know, I remember truck drivers say, well, you know, we need to stop taking cheap freight. And there they are cutting each other's throats for pennies. Now they're all in the fish tank. What will they do now?
Well, one of the things about the militarization of the border is rather unsettling, is I think that they're kind of looking forward to that, too. So, I mean, another way that we can go at this is to track the stuff and to identify, and you know, like boycotting, right? Don't buy the stuff. Don't buy the stuff that's coming up that way. Don't buy the stuff that's being carried that way. I was saying before, one of the reasons I started Combating Globalization is I've been trying to get people to share their ideas, you know, with that as a forum. I set it up as a you know, forum on Combating Globalization and say, what worked for you? What's worked anywhere? And I think I was a little bit ahead of the curve on it. I think you were right when you started your introduction that we have more people. It's affecting more people now, more people going out of work and more people, you know, I think we're approaching a critical mass, but we need to start exchanging information on how it works. I know when we were doing, we had this Corridor Watch, which was a Texas organization. We had little groups, from Highway 69 outside of Minneapolis, Evansville, Indiana, who came down and made a film, you know, about the other end of the 69 corridor, which is kind of a joke. They should have picked up some other numbers because there's been some terrible jokes about that going on here. But that's the one that runs right outside my door.
Right.
That's going to come through Texas and go to the Central Eastern Corridor up through Arkansas and, you know, headed your way.
And that's what's going to bring it right into our backyard. And that's what's dangerous about the warehouses that have been built here in the last several years. It's only a hop, skip, and a jump down the road.
But, Rick, I've been following this very carefully in Texas. So the biggest warehouse, in fact, the reason I started following this whole issue, the biggest warehouse that Walmart ever made, they only leased it for 5 years, okay? And I thought, that's odd. Why would you build a warehouse that big, and they got tax abatements from Baytown, Texas, that couldn't afford it and stuff? And they built this huge warehouse because they were picking, you know, they had contract haulers shuttling from Bayport Container Yard up to Baytown where this center was, because they're going to shut it down. They were planning on keeping it open. This has been a long-range plan to move all this south of the border and offshore all the jobs that they can. So with the, you know, they're widening the Panama Canal right now, and as we speak, and nobody knows about this either, please come to Combating Globalization and, you know, learn about this kind of stuff. But in Mexico, in Veracruz, and in Altamira, which is near Tampico, they're building container yards. Altamira is where Kmart plans on landing most of their freight. So once the Panama Canal gets open, the Panama Canal, widening the Panama Canal might kill that Punta Colinet thing. Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah, we'll see.
But they're planning on bringing it through the Panama Canal and going up to Altamira and unloading right at Altamira, which is near Tampico, and shooting it straight up the Texas coast, straight up Arkansas, straight up your backyard. You're exactly right.
Which is why we've got to stop this. Richard Vogel, combatingglobalization.com. I appreciate the time. Thanks for the information. Well, this is going to be a hot issue, and we're going to have you back again real soon.
Yeah, we need a follow-up because what I'm saying, we need to watch this. July 6th, the Memorandum of Understanding was signed on this new program. And according to my paper down here, the trucks are going to move in 2 months. Okay?
Yep.
And we can follow them because there's people like the Free Trade Alliance in San Antonio, Texas on their website. They talk about when this stuff's going to start moving. Those were the people that engineered this whole thing and it promoted this whole thing. They work with the Chamber of Commerce and everything else. So we need a study, get the details, understand the total strategy and how it fits in, and start drawing other people in. I mean, there's not enough union, you know, there's not enough union people left to turn this around.
Yep.
We have to outreach to the younger, you know, the youngsters, and that's one of the reasons to go on the internet and you know, go to Facebook and reach out to them too, because these are the kids that are never going to go to work.
That's the part of this.
We start making the connection with them about what's happening, like the austerity programs that's happening to us and the pensions that are, you know, being gobbled up down here and canceled, that it's all part of the same picture of the war against the working class that's been going on since Taft, hardly 1947. And we need to do our homework.
I'm right there with you. Could not agree with you more, Richard.
Okay.
I appreciate it, brother.
Okay, sir.
We'll talk to you soon. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. What do you think? What's hot in your mind? 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Are you as angry about this as I am? We're right back.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
They're back. Citigroup, Coca-Cola, IBM, Merck, and dozens of other major U.S. corporations are back in Washington like hogs at the trough, demanding to be fed another tax boondoggle. This is not the first pig out for these oinkers. In 2005, having stashed huge profits in foreign countries and tax havens, the multinational giants came to Washington offering Congress a heck of a deal. We'll bring this money back to the U.S. and invest it here, creating beaucoup jobs, if you give us a sweetheart tax rate on our profits of only about 5%, rather than the usual 35% rate. The Bushites and GOP Congress enthusiastically took the bait. Sure enough, $312 billion came home. But instead of investing it in job creation, top executives and big shareholders simply put it in their pockets. 60% of the boondoggle was gobbled up by only 15 of America's biggest multinationals, many of which actually shut down American plants, fired thousands of workers, and moved more of their production abroad. Merck, for example, brought nearly $16 billion home in October 2005, then announced a restructuring plan the next month to close U.S. plants and cut some 3,500 jobs. You could almost hear the executives chortle and say, "Thanks, suckers." Well, look out, for a corporate lobbying front is working with Republican House leaders to sucker us again. The group includes such super-rich computer giants as Apple, Dell, Google, and Intel pushing for what they call a repatriation holiday. With a big stage wink, they promise to create jobs in exchange for that same dandy 5% tax deal. This is Jim Hightower saying, what gross hoggishness. State and national budgets are being slashed, and these fat greedheads are trying to scam America with a tax holiday for themselves. To fight their greed, go to usuncut.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside they're just feeling small and scared. And they need to know that someone out there cares. Have you heard the Republicans today? Have you tried to spread your love to those who love the NRA? Though they might be quite reluctant because they'll wonder if you're gay. You should hug the Republicans today.
Yeah, why not? I'll give him a big hug and a big sloppy wet kiss. They'll probably shoot you, though. Homophobes that they are. Anyway, in going back to this whole this Mexican border thing, and this is what I've been saying for the longest time, and Richard, pretty much the expert on this topic, which is why we brought him on. The reality is this issue for me is not so much just about the driver going back and forth. It's about all of the warehouse jobs. It's about all of the manufacturing jobs, and it is about the driver jobs. And he's right. The Teamsters really don't really have a stake in this so much because they don't represent very many long haul drivers. Because the reality is there are very few company long haul drivers. They're mostly owner operators. They're mostly guys who said, "I'm gonna start my own company. I'm gonna be Joe's truck." And you can thank Carter for that when he signed deregulation. We now made it easier for one guy to start up his own company and start slitting the guy's throat next to him for a couple of pennies, and we saw this race to the bottom. Whenever we start talking about unfettered competition, we talk about laissez-faire capitalism, I look at the trucking industry. You got guys, and I've got friends who, they're home 4 or 5 days a year. They live on the road. They live in those trucks like caged animals. That's their life. And once they get into it, and I've got friends who want to get out of it, but once you get into it, you're kind of trapped. And now what this is going to do is this is going to harm them irreparably. And it's not going to be right away. They're going to do their pilot thing, and you're going to see, and they're going to make a big production of how safe the drivers are. They're all driving new equipment and how well that they're, keeping track of it. It's going to be a whole PR scheme. It's going to be a couple of years, but mark my word. The Ross Perot giant sucking sound. This is the giant second sound on steroids, because this now gives them open access to the country. Now a manufacturer can run down there and still get their product right to their warehouse or right to the store. You know what we're going to have left in this country? Stores. My only question is who's going to have money to buy this stuff? I mean, the grand engineers, the people who think this is going to work, you got to start wondering who's going to buy your cars, who's going to buy your big screen TVs if nobody has any money. And look, at the end of this, the drivers are the ones who are getting screwed. You're going to pay the exact same price for shipping. We learned that from the deregulation. The price of moving stuff didn't come down all that much for consumers. Came down for shippers a little bit. And then it went right back up because you got these freight brokers involved. And now we see that their revenue in the first quarter of this year has jumped by over 17% as they're finding that, their third-party logistic companies are expanding faster than they did last year. Why? They've got the work, and they're able to extract it out of their drivers. These brokers, these are the people who then we added to the middle of this system. And said, we're going to take wages away from those workers to pay these brokers. That's what's happened. And, if you could go back to the era of deregulation and stop it, which is why I'm amazed that you still hear people, Jake, saying, well, we need to deregulate. We need to streamline things, make it less regulations. You look at the freight industry. To me, it's a perfect example of everything that's wrong with deregulation. You know, those used to be jobs that people had lives. It's an industry now where, you know, I knew a guy for a while. He worked for one of the big truckload carriers. He used to go to homeless shelters and find, you know, guys in their early 30s and say, "You want a job at a house?" "Yep." Couple of week training there in Milwaukee, or the other one, I forget where John Boyden goes, where J.B. Hunt goes, but you know, 2 week training course, boom, you got a job in a house, driving all over the country, making $28,000-$30,000 a year. Amazing stuff.
Pretty much making minimum wage.
Well, I mean, there is the book Sweatshop on Wheels. I mean, it basically is minimum wage. And I feel sorry for those guys because it's hard work. It's dedicated work. It's thankless work. Yeah, I did it for years. And you know what? It's sad. This is going to be sad to see. And I got to be honest. I fear what's going to happen. And like Richard Vogel said, it's part of why they're militarizing the border. You know, when you start looking at it in a different perspective, you know, we have people say, well, we need to control our borders, but we're going to open it up to trucks. We need to control our borders for those people, but trailers we can pull through. And Richard said something I think most people didn't know, that there's actually a dedicated line for the multinationals to bring their trucks through. Probably not going to be inspected. They'll have one of those little things, little metal detector things go over top, you know, scanning it for radiation or something. But for the most part, straight on through. And expect the drug problem to go up.
And he said something which I wasn't aware of. I'm sure most Americans are. He said the roads in this highway are better in Mexico than they are in Texas.
Because they're private. I mean, this is part of what was supposed to be. And, you know, most people debunk it. It's the NAFTA superhighway. But this is a private road that's going to be tolled. And the profiteers will make big money off of it. The people who lose are the workers. And now imagine all those jobs now. Gone off of Texas, so that the Texas with they made the most minimum wage jobs in the country, going to be all gone soon. 1-888-520-RICK. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Back after this.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., our good friend Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for us.
Delighted.
The debt talks seem to be all front and center.
Yes, very big deal. There is a meeting on Sunday night at 6 p.m., President and the Vice President meeting with congressional leadership, as I said, at 6 in the Cabinet Room. They're meeting with Speaker Boehner, Harry Reid, Mitch McConnell, Nancy Pelosi, Eric Cantor, Dick Durbin, John Kyle, and Steny Hoyer, maybe others, but they're the key members. Now, the president wants to go for the big deal. You know, he wants to do something big. This has been a theme of his presidency. And that would be the $4 trillion deficit reduction deal that really includes a dramatic revamp of the tax code and significant curbs in entitlements. And they'll know pretty soon whether they've got any chance of persuading the congressional rank and file to do that. They'll also know very early on whether everybody's on board with that. It was interesting. Yesterday, 6 of the 8 lawmakers in the room said they'd like to try to go for the $4 trillion deal.
Right.
Two of them said no.
Well, most of them, you know, most of them, they want the special deal. They want the big thing. They're going to give up the little box on the table for what's behind door number 3.
Well, the two who said they would go to the small deal, not the big deal, were Kyle and Cantor. And Kyle is the Senate Republican whip, and Cantor used to be the House whip. And they both count votes, and they both said that they do not believe that they could sell this to their troops.
Well, how much of this do you think because, you know, I've been beating up Obama pretty much since putting Social Security on the table, because I don't think it belongs on the table. And nobody but him, I think, decided to put it on the table. How much of this do you think is, as Krugman says, the anti-Corleone making a deal they can't accept?
I think a fair bit of it might be making a deal they can't accept. I mean, I think some of it may be. I think he is trying to appear to independents to be the adult in the room. He's trying to be the one who will appear, and he is trying to be A, but B, to appear to be, like Caesar's wife, the one who is saying, look, I'm not only putting Medicare on the table, now I'm putting Social Security on the table. Look what I'm offering. I'm offering everything. I'm offering the farm. What are Republicans offering? They're still saying not only no new taxes, but you've got this right flank who are saying we won't do anything without a balanced budget amendment and significant spending cuts. So he's trying to make it seem as though he's the one person who's trying to get a deal. Now, he's not being helped, quite honestly, by some Democrats who, even though they may not be happy with this, might have better served him in terms of his reelection prospects and everybody staying together if they had spoken privately rather than going in front of the cameras before they had a meeting with him at 10 o'clock this morning.
Yeah, I think that's a key because, to be honest, he has taken a decidedly rightward-leaning position on a lot of things. The whole, we need more free trade, you know, we need to get, you know, government back in line, we need to cut spending to create jobs. He almost sounds like a Republican.
Well, I think... Well, he clearly doesn't, because the free trade deal isn't going forward because he wants assistance for people who've lost their jobs, and it's just been stalled once again because the Republicans won't allow it through with that.
Which is one of those things that amazes me. If it's going to create so many jobs here in the country, as they keep claiming, why not throw that in there? Because you have the utmost confidence it's going to create jobs. I'm not getting it.
It's you know, it's very interesting. A little bit of sort of TikTok on this. If they're able to make a deal this weekend, there is the matter of the calendar. And if they're able to make a deal this weekend, it's more likely only going to be a pledge to make a deal.
Right.
Well, then they've got to make it into a legislation. That's going to make it be at least another week of round-the-clock work by staff members. Then they've got to rewrite tax. That's an agreement that's going to buy a couple of months for the details to be drafted and debated separately. So basically, this means we're getting towards the week of July the 25th before legislation's getting debated and voted on in the House and the Senate. So it's all getting pretty tight.
Yeah, so let me ask you this, though. Let's say nothing happens. Let's say they, because part of me already thinks they have an agreement in place. They're just figuring out how to best sell it so that they all look pretty good. But I think at some level they all have kind of a wink-nod agreement somewhere. But let's say they don't. and nothing happens, and we come up to August 2nd. Have you been hearing much talk of the president using the constitutional tool that some think is possible for him?
No. No talk of it at all. The White House is at great pains to say, no, we're not considering it. We're not even researching it. What we have heard is that there are some Senate Republicans who are dropping a sense of a Senate resolution saying this is rubbish.
So the report yesterday, we talked to the guy who said, if he does that, we're going to impeach him. Not much talk of that?
Well, there may be talk of it from the right, but, I mean, from the White House, they're not talking about using it. Now, they say that they haven't been investigating it. Whether since that answer to that question was given, they've started investigating it, it's hard to say, or whether they have people outside investigating it, because I don't think the question was asked comprehensively enough to include that.
Right.
I don't know.
Interesting. It'll be interesting to see where this takes us over the weekend. I know I will be glued to my television set, which is very rare for me on a Sunday.
Yes, me too.
Victoria Jones, I appreciate the time and look forward to talking to you again very soon.
Thank you so much.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Now to find out what we've got going on across the street. What's going on, Jake?
Yeah, thanks, Rick. We're speaking more and more the last couple of weeks about workers fighting back all over the country against these dragooning in cuts in benefits and also a tax on workers. I just want to give you a couple of these examples. In New Jersey, Communication Workers of America, Local 1030, has filed a lawsuit last week over the failure of Governor Christie to make payments to the state's pension funds. Working men and women are also suing to stop several laws in Idaho. One of them was a law which was trying to outlaw PLAs. PLAs have been popular in the construction industry. They really enhance these projects. They make them cheaper on time. They make sure that there's adequate management of these projects. They also make sure there's adequate funding. And the Republicans in that state have gone after them. They have a foul lawsuit, and it looks like they have a good chance of winning that. There's some other places in Wisconsin. A broad coalition of union groups have filed lawsuits challenging the constitutionality of Wisconsin's new law restricting collective bargaining rights. In Michigan, citizens organized by the Sugar Law Center in Detroit filed suit against the state power to intervene in financially troubled municipalities and school districts. In Ohio, the American Civil Liberties Unions announced yesterday that is preparing a case, a lawsuit and a plan in Ohio to require voters. They're filing a lawsuit against Ohio's plan to require voter ID. And the Indiana State Teachers Association has filed a lawsuit against a statewide voucher program. So workers and their allies are filing these draconian anti-union and undemocratic cuts all over the country, and that's good to see. Some very, very interesting numbers coming out of some polling in Pennsylvania, Rick. Senator Casey has sent a bullish warning this week to Republicans thinking of challenging him in 2012, and this is the message. They'll face more than $3 million in television and radio ads, door-to-door canvassing, and campaign literature drops. It was enough for State Senator Jay Cormer, who's a Republican from Center County, up around State College, to bow out, according to the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thursday, State GOP Chairman Bob Gleason counted that President Barack Obama's dipping Pennsylvania approval rating will drag Casey down and lift up the anointed Republican challenger, according to the Philadelphia Inquirer. Obama continues to be on political life support in Pennsylvania, according to the latest numbers from the public policy polling. His Keystone approval disapproval rating is drowning at 46-48%, and most voters in the state have expressed disapproval of him in all three of the organization's 2011 polls. Public policy polling says that Pennsylvania Republicans will have to push for Mitt Romney to be the national nominee because he's the only announced GOP candidate whose numbers are competitive with Obama's. Pennsylvania numbers have Romney and Obama neck to neck, while other Republican presidential hopefuls trail the president by as much as 7 points. That includes native son Rick Santorum, who has pledged in a recent campaign style that as president he will restore American manufacturing. Meanwhile, Texas Representative Ron Paul, who grew up around Pittsburgh and attended Gettysburg College, is also pushing forward in his bid to become a presidential candidate. He raised an impressive $4.5 million last quarter and has bought up about 75,000 in radio ads in a run-up to the Ames, Iowa straw poll. Despite raising $2 million this last quarter, one of our favorites, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, who, by the way, was born just a couple miles from here. Presidential campaign is about $1 million in debt. And the Gingrich campaign, a drain brain, continues as he's lost another key operative, his Iowa campaign manager, to Texas Governor Rick Perry's White House bid. Pennsylvania is going to be a very key state for the president, depending on the vote in other states. A defeat in Pennsylvania could mean a failed reelection bid in 2012. These are not good numbers for the president.
Well, there you go. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happy!
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin, but the way she is. Everything's raisin, but the way she is. Gasoline, groceries, and our haters. Everything's raisin, but the way she is.
Well, this might be an interesting thing for the Santorums and the Bachmans of the world to try in Britain. They've got this bizarre kind of controversial lottery going on. They've got the media there has dubbed it a win a baby contest, where, you know, they, prospective parents are given the chance to win thousands of pounds towards the expensive in vitro fertilization. Again, you know, you go, really? We're going to spend a lot of money doing this? Yeah, but according to Britain's Gaming Commission, It has granted a license for the fertility charity. To Hatch is the name. It's going to run the game from July 30th. Every month, winners can scoop up 25,000 pounds, which is a little over $40,000 worth of tailor-made treatments for one of UK's top five fertility clinics for a price of about 20 pounds a ticket. So there you go. It's one of those things I really think that the religious right here, I can see that taking off here in this country. I can see that being the church lottery. It's going to be bingo night, in vitro fertilization night at the bingo hall. No more basket bingo, no more none of that nonsense. We'll get you shots in the behind. Because that's where they shoot you. God bless you. I remember seeing I was reading one of those parade magazines once, and in there they were talking about this woman who had five children through, evidently they did whatever they did. It was right around the time of the Octomom who then had eight. But they were interviewing a friend of this woman who had just, had five kids, and, she was saying, it's tough on her, but God wouldn't give her more than she could handle. And, I guess I'm the only person who thought, well, God didn't want her to have any. It was man who decided she was going to have five. And I wonder now, and I think about this, every once in a while, I wonder how those kids are now. It's just one of those things that pops into my head every once in a while. It's tough to live in my world. I got to tell you, I love Florida. Florida is the home of crazy. Florida is the home of, bizarre stuff going on. But there in Florida, Coca-Cola officials have now announced new fountain drink machines that can be found at the Burger King locations there in Florida. Also in a couple of other places, the Pee Wee Asian Diners and the Miami Subs and Grill that offer up to 125 different varieties of Coke products. And I'm going, does Coke have 125 different varieties of product? I didn't think they did. But evidently, this machine will now make you Coke with orange, and Sprite with peach, basically doing all those things that six-year-olds do, making different concoctions. This machine will do for you for a small sum. 125 varieties. And I wonder who sat down and said, okay, here's a variety. We're going to take Sprite and Coke, and we're going to put them together. And I go, but that tastes just like ginger ale. Can I just have ginger ale? No, you're getting a different variety. Ginger ale is its own variety. 125. It's pretty amazing, don't you think? They're calling it the iPods of fountain machines. I don't understand what the hell that means. But it means something to them. So there you go, 125 different varieties of sugary garbage to drink with high fructose corn syrup. Very nice. Corn sugar. It's no longer high fructose corn syrup. It's corn sugar because it sounds more like something natural. Also from Florida, a Florida woman said that she has collected 619 pink flamingos. That's right. She now has a place in the Guinness Book of World Records for having collected flamingo paraphernalia. She has 619 of them. And, she was yelling in the parking lot, woohoo, praise the Lord, we did it. And I'm going, what did the Lord have to do with you being nuts enough to put 619 of these ugly flamingos in your front yard? And then I find out that somehow what we thought we used to play flamingo baseball with when I was a kid, and I was not always this upstanding citizen that I am now. Sometimes we would drive by and hit the flamingos with a bat. I'm not proud of that. But now this has become some kind of a religious thing. Have you seen this? That now, people, you remember when I was a kid, you would go and you would toilet paper someone's house. Did you ever do that? Did they use toilet paper back when you were a kid?
Yes, they did around Halloween. Yeah.
Around Halloween, you used toilet paper?
No, we used to call it tic-tacking,
Oh, okay. But, when I was a kid, that's what you did. You'd TP people's houses. Evidently, in the Christian world, they now flamingo people's houses. I did not know this. Because I've gone past a couple of places and said, yep, that's what these people do. And I'm going, wow, that's big fun. I didn't make it up. It's reality. Don't look at me with that stupid look like I made this up.
I must have missed this on ESPN. I guess I missed that biggie.
It is exactly the insanity that it sounds like.
Everybody was born for a purpose, I guess.
And theirs was putting flamingos in people's front yards and going, woo, we won. And finally, the last thing I want to talk about tonight. Again, I love Republicans and their stupid stunts. Ohio State Representative Robert Mecklenburg decided he was going to go to Indiana. That's right. The 59-year-old married father of three was visiting one of those places where the young ladies take off their clothing. Had a couple of spirits, if you will. Evidently had a couple too many, because when the police pulled him over for not having a headlight, he ended up having a blood test of 0.097%. Oopsie. The other part of it is the 59-year-old father of three, good God-fearing Christian Republican, couldn't explain why there was a 26-year-old female passenger who just happened to be one of the young ladies from the establishment that take off their clothing. I understand Mr. Mecklenburg is one of the folks who has moved forward with the request that Ohio return next week to vote on the restrictive voter ID bill that he is sponsoring.
But he was acting fatherly, and he was probably giving her a ride home.
He was count that. There you go. That's a good, because he's an attorney. I mean, and he was very, I watched the video. It was pretty funny. I love those on the side of the road video where touch your nose. He ends up touching the cop's nose or something. But, here again, maybe that's a good, I was just counseling her, sir.
Oh, ye of little faith. You would impugn the integrity of an outstanding citizen.
Here's the thing. Maybe he has the best of intentions. Maybe he did. And you know what? Maybe we should give him the benefit of the doubt. I'm not going to. But maybe we should, that maybe, this 59-year-old father of three, Ohio State Republican legislator, taking a little time in the state of Indiana to blow off a little steam, or maybe have a little blown off of him. I don't know, one or the other. Maybe he was just counseling this young lass. Maybe he was, helping her to learn the ways of the ills of her ways. Now, there was a hotel where he was pulling into. I don't know that that's the chapel that, and maybe the kind of preaching and confessing he was going to be doing in a hotel room. I don't know.
And she could have been staying there.
could have, but we will now never know. And I looked at him and I said, I'm sure this is not the way you had planned your evening to go. I'm sure he had his mind in other places. And what bothers me is that he got pulled over for something stupid like a headlight. Again, another one of those reasons that the cops pull you over. But you should have done a pre-trip there, buddy. Anyway, I want to thank all the folks who came on the program tonight. Of course, our good friend Richard Vogel from Combating Globalization, and also Professor Dow Schmidt, professor at Indiana University, for his talk on the NLRB. We've got that up at our site at TheRickSmithShow.com. Of course, if you missed any portion of the program, feel free to download it at TheRickSmithShow.com onto your iPod, or just listen to it on our website. I hope everybody has a great weekend. This has been one of those good weeks. Look forward to seeing you back here on Monday. Again, if you want to contact us between now and Monday, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. And by all means, please, please stay away from the places where the ladies take their clothes off. And if you go, don't drink and drive. And if you're lucky enough to bring one back with you, keep it to yourself. We'll see you Monday.
Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Tomorrow.
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.